Coming up on today's BPR, 10 hours before the State of the Union, CNN's John King previews the speech, and can the pig castrating Jody Ernst deliver a compelling Republican response? Then Deborah Hughes has devoted her life to homeless, battered women and their kids. She'll join us to discuss her agenda in a state where homelessness grows faster than anywhere else. And speaking of agenda, on the day we learned the top 1% control 50% of the world's wealth, most think that's a problem. But will they support Barack Obama's cure?
As he enters his 20th year as conductor of the Boston Pops, Keith Lockhart shares with us his world-famous mashed potato recipe. Is the Patriots deflategate really about soft footballs or more about jealousy with Tom Terrific Brady, Bill Belichick, and all these perfect things in life? As jury selection continues in the marathon bombing trial, Dave Wedge and Casey Sherman on a new book on the bombing, then the guys from This Old House. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
And good morning, Marjorie.
I should say, if people haven't seen it, lovely, lovely drawing of Jim in the business section of the Boston Globe.
It's a caricature, it's not a
caricature.
Drawing.
Yeah, he's looking a little suspicious.
Yeah. I think I look actually quite...
Actually, you look very fetching, Jim.
Fetching,
people haven't seen it. Check it out. It's great. Business section, Boston Globe.
Thank
today.
You. Not that
big
I
news.
Remember, but it's on page C6. In any case, tonight, I guess it's roughly 10 hours from now, President Obama kicks off his State of the Union address with his approval rating, at least in one poll, up to 50%. Which could go up or down depending on how he positions himself as populist in chief. Will his middle class agenda, headlined by his push for free community colleges and obviously some tax changes, get a partisan standing O? Will his tax hikes on the richest of the rich become a GOP punching bag? Who knows? One guy does. Joining us on the line to go over what's at stake for Congress, the president, and the presidential wannabes is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John also hosts the Sunday morning show, Inside Politics. Hey, John.
And John's going to buy a couple globes to stack up on page C6.
C6.
I only have a couple hundred copies left, so if it runs out, you know my number.
That's right. Jim, close the presses over there on Morrissey Boulevard in Dorchester. So John King, Barack Obama's giving his so-called Robin Hood tax plan speech tonight in the State of the Union. We do have a Republican-controlled Congress now. What is this about? It doesn't seem like the GOP is going to go for the Robin Hood approach. Is this about the setting the stage for 2016?
I think it is largely. Let's see. Let's not give up on the possibility that at some point a tax reform bill will become a negotiating vehicle between the president and the Republicans, and then maybe he can get some of this. But I think right now, if you look at it, look, the president, a lot of people would say, where's this populist Barack Obama coming from? Where's this been for 6 years? And what the White House would say is, well, remember, and our memories are short sometimes, how horrible the economy was when he came into office. We had the financial crisis. You thought you might have collapse on Wall Street still, 10% unemployment early in his administration. His argument is there's finally enough economic growth that Washington can start to do some bigger things with the economy and with the tax code. And he says it's time to take some money from big wealthy people or big wealthy banks and give it back to middle-class families who need some help. Well, that's his argument. Republicans are going to say, we just won an election, 31 governors, a Senate majority, a bigger House majority, by saying that you were wrong, Mr. President, and that government is not the answer, and that more spending is not the answer, or more Washington control and Washington rules is not the answer. So from a policy perspective, they are at polar opposites. But there is this. The Republicans have to defend that Senate majority in 2016 when you've got Kelly Ayotte up the road from you guys in New Hampshire, Toomey in Pennsylvania, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, vulnerable Republicans in states that tend to go blue in presidential election years. So is there enough political pressure at some point where Republicans say we just can't keep saying no? We need to get, we need to move some middle class numbers our way, too. So is there some place down the road where there could be a deal? And most people in this town think, no, I'm not completely willing to close it off yet just because of Republican self-interest.
You know what I wonder, John King? You've been out in the so-called hinterlands, out in the middle of America, the southwestern coast of America, all these places that I haven't been to. So you have an insight that I don't. But it seems like the evidence is so mounting now. We're going to talk about this later on in the show, this new Oxfam report that says half of global wealth is held by the 1%. You have more and more Republicans, Mitt Romney, Marco Rubio, talking about having to do something about the poor in America. Income inequality has become like a household word now. There's more and more sense, you know, that there's an increasing gap here. So you wonder why it is we have people like Orrin Hatch trying to say, oh no, this is just about ruining everything for the middle class, ruining everything for small businesses. People in the hinterlands, do they buy this? I mean, the evidence seems to be overwhelming.
Well, there's a couple layers to it. There's no question. Look, I can sit down with my siblings and have this conversation, and I think it's everywhere. And it's even among people who are doing okay right now who aren't struggling. But certainly if you get out into rural America, more so, and where what I call the American dream idea. You know, I knew growing up that I was going to have a better life than my parents, and that was my parents' goal. That's what they, you know, fought for. A lot of parents look around the table now and look at their kids, and they're not so sure. That, you know, college is so expensive, and even if you go through and spend all that money, what are the jobs out for those kids? Is the economy geared, and is our education system geared toward, you know, where the economy is heading in the years ahead? This is a gnawing question at families. Now, some of those very families, though, Marjorie, will say, but it's not the government's job, or I don't want Washington telling me what to do, or Washington manipulating the tax code. They don't think that's the way to get there. There's, you know, even people who feel that pressure. Some of them are, I don't know if conservative is the right word, but less Washington-focused and the like. But I do think that's why I haven't completely slammed the door shut on that at some point. With the president's numbers going up, number one, he has a little bit more leverage. Number two, we're going into an election cycle. How do we think Hillary Clinton is different from Barack Obama? We'll see if this turns out to be true. But the Democratic hope is that she keeps most of his coalition, meaning African-Americans and Latinos and younger people, together, and she does better than President Obama among working-class whites. We certainly saw that in the Democratic primaries in 2008. That was her constituency. And for reasons including race, not only race, but reasons including race, that's where the President Obama has consistently struggled. So if you're a Republican going into that year, and again, your Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania needs those votes, your Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire needs those votes, do you feel some pressure to come to the table and do something to help the middle class? And maybe you say to the president, your heart's in the right place, your intentions are good, we believe it's the wrong policy approach. You've crafted what you want to do wrong. Let's work out a compromise. Will that happen? I'm probably nuts to suggest it, but I do think there is enough political pressure coming on Republicans, especially if the president can keep his numbers up and the Democrats look strong heading into the 2016 cycle. It's not going to happen in the next 2 weeks or 2 months, but it could happen down the road.
But it seems to me that the perfect compromise for the Republicans to show that they, too, care about the middle class is to embrace all the spending that Obama wants for the middle class and none of the taxing of the wealthy. I mean, he wants to do something with a tax credit for families, expand the child care tax credit, education tax breaks, expanding the earned income tax credit. It seems to me they'll embrace most of that, spend us more into a deficit, and convince the American public yet again, which they've done brilliantly for decades, that all those 1% who those radicals like Barack Obama are angry at, they're the ones that create the jobs that allow you to keep feeding your family. So isn't that the perfect split the baby approach? Spend the money and protect your wealthy friends.
It might have been 5 or even 10 years ago. I think in the Tea Party America, with the Republican-based politics and primary politics like they are, that right now any kind of a tax revenue increase is taboo. But more importantly, more spending and more deficits would really set off an additional revolt or reignite the depth and the volume of the revolt within the Republican coalition. So I don't think they can do that. I think a large sweeping tax reform bill is the only way to do this, in which the price for the Republicans would be lower rates, lower corporate rates, maybe even some lower rates on wealthy individuals, but clean up the loopholes. And, you know, if a tiny bit of more revenue came to Washington, but the business community and the wealthy community and the banking community all said we're fine with this, you know, then you might have groups like Rover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform, or the Club for Growth saying, you know, this is horrible because 20 more cents is going to get to Washington, D.C. But it wouldn't have as much appeal if most of the Republican coalition was for it. And some of the people getting the benefit happen to be, you know, middle-class Republicans or middle-class independents or conservative Democrats who are available sometimes to Republicans in the elections. I think you have to do it as part of a big package. If they do piecemeal things that the Tea Party or some of the spending groups on the conservative side could hold up, you know, that one piece of legislation says this is a tax increase or this is more deficit spending, Boehner and McConnell McConnell are not going to sign off on that because they know that their members just won't go for it.
One more
a big deal, maybe. Again, I know I'm nuts to even hold out the possibility, but I live an optimist.
You know, one more thing, at least from me, John King, about tonight's speech is, so on all this tax the wealthy stuff, whether it's the estate tax or these big financial firms' fees on them, obviously that's a direct challenge to the Republicans. And the Democrats, like Jack in the Boxes, I hate that in the State of the Union. They'll, like, spring to their feet while all the Republicans sit on their hands and vice versa, whatever. What is the bone he's going to throw to Republican majorities to show, I actually do want to work with you? Something clear and easy that the American people and reporters like you will say, this was his one olive branch or one of several tonight. What's that going to be?
But the question is, if he acknowledges the election results, number one, and says that there's a lesson in there for him, don't bet on it. And number two, there's some tension in the Democratic Party as to whether the president will talk about his hopes and goals for more trade authority, free trade authority, and say that that's an idea where he can work with Republicans. Uh-huh. The question for me is there any diplomatic language in there that, you know, acknowledges that it's Mitch McConnell, not Harry Reid, acknowledges Speaker Boehner, who will be up behind him, has more numbers? I wouldn't look for it. From a political standpoint, the consultants would tell you the election's over. It's time to stay on offense, not defense. But let's watch and see how that plays out. There are some foreign policy areas. If he talks about Cuba, the Republicans will be mad. If he talks about ISIS, he, for the most part, has Republican support. But on the domestic agenda, look, we're waiting on the Supreme Court to deal with Obamacare. Now the Supreme Court's going to deal with same-sex marriage. On domestic issues, by and large, this president and Republicans are in parallel universes, and I don't expect he can find any words. They're going to bridge that gap.
But, you know, when you look at something, Jim called it the capital gain tax. Other people call it the trust fund loophole. When you look at something which seems like really a total scam, is the hope – well, it does. It really does. And if people – I mean, if you – old buddy of mine, Michael Hilsick from the LA Times, got a great explainer about it that was in the paper just yesterday. Yesterday. Explains what it means. And I think it's a total scam. I think anybody looked at it would be a total scam. So what Republicans hope is that people – aren't astute enough to realize it's a total scam, because there's no kind of trickle-down kind of defense of this I don't think you could possibly make. So is that what they hope? That people aren't paying attention?
It's some of that, but I think it's also to the degree that if they raise taxes here, then they're going to use that money and they're going to spend it on things, and then they're going to want more. And once they're done raising taxes on the rich, you're next. There's some of that. And there are legitimate philosophical divides in this country, ideological divides in this country over whether Washington should be getting more money or less money, whether Washington should be telling you or should be subsidizing things like college education. Now, again, if you pay for it in the right way, a quick poll would probably show pretty good support for that. But when you start asking questions about Washington and taxes and education, it breaks down. So it's complicated. To your basic point, the Republican argument mostly is, and you hear this when they propose background checks on guns. You know, well, if they do this time, what will they do next?
Yeah.
Or once they win this one, what are they going to come back for next?
So we're talking with John King from CNN. John, you mentioned earlier that Barack Obama's approval rates are up around 50% now. So what happened?
That's a great question. Is it a little bit of buyer's remorse from the voters after giving Republicans big wins? Is it a little bit of, okay, we have divided government now, and we're happy the Republicans run the House, and we're happy Republicans run the Senate, but we do need a check, in a Democratic president? Has it just been that I said something about this morning on television, and a Republican responded to me on Twitter saying, no, people feel better about the country because we're exactly two years from today, and he'll be gone. Again, all of these issues we're talking about, people view through the prism of their politics. And the saddest part for me in Washington is after this election, where the Republicans did win big at every level, is that there was no timeout, and both parties are to blame. Yeah. Whether it's the politicians sniping at each other right out of the box, or the president's issued 5 veto threats already. Congress has barely been in town. And the Republicans have said, Mr. President, we're not going to give you anything you want. And the staff send these snipey, partisan, petty fifth-grade emails around town all day so they get posted on blogs out there. There was no timeout after the election to say, how about we all be quiet for a little bit, take a deep breath, don't give up on your beliefs, but just don't kick people in the teeth, and see if we could have 6 days, if not 6 months, of trying to govern before we start the next election cycle. Well, that didn't happen. We are full bore into the next cycle.
You know, John, I hate to return to my favorite part of the States of the Union, where you're probably laughing at me politely, is I love the jumping up and not jumping up thing. And I love when members of the House, for example, before they decide whether to applaud, they have to see if John Boehner is applauding. If he's not applauding, you can't. But there's some tough ones for them tonight. For example, when Barack Obama says, I've already done an executive order on immigration, but I want to go further to comprehensive immigration reform. While Boehner will not applaud, does someone like Marco Rubio, who arguably wants to be president, does he stand up in a sea of seated Republicans? Does he applaud? I mean, there are going to be some surprising moments, no?
I'm looking for those, and especially you mentioned there's a handful of people, and, you know, when the president says, let's take higher fees from banks with, you know, big debt and big wealthy banks, the Elizabeth in a box, I'm sure, will pop up. You know, and everybody will have an eye on her, saying, "Is Elizabeth Warren going to run for president?" We'll be looking at Ted Cruz, and we'll be looking at Marco Rubio, and we'll be looking at Rand Paul, because there are some potential presidents. Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, right down there on the floor. We'll be watching that. I think that the Republicans are not going to be jumping up and down a lot, and I don't think there's much the president can say or wants to say to get them up. I do think that, you know, the president wants to essentially try to say is, you know, essentially exhale. I mean, he's not going to do it this way, but just let out a long whew and say we can finally start talking about these things now because the economy is in better shape. Whether we agree or disagree, for a couple of years we couldn't even have the conversation because the economy was still bleeding. There was, you know, you could not touch the patients. But I see this as a very, and it, again, we just had an election. You would think we'd try to have a governing period, but I think we're right back into the polarization. And so I'll be interested to see, you know, what is that moment, if there is a moment, either where the Republicans rise with him. And, I mean, you can do this when you salute people in the audience, and I don't mean those. When you salute some of the special
guests,
sure,
obviously,
you do that, right. Obviously. But is there a policy moment that, A, gets the Republicans up for him, and is there what you're talking about? Is there one of those, oh, God, what do I do now? He's up, he's down, he's up, he's down, you know, look at my BlackBerry real quick to tell me what my pollster tells me, and then get up. I don't know if we'll have any of those.
You know, John, can we talk for a couple minutes about the woman who, in my estimation, has the worst job in America at about 10 o'clock tonight? Here's a piece from a famous ad from Joni Ernst, who, by the way, has been a senator for about a minute and a half. She's delivering the Republican response. Here she is.
I'm Joni Ernst. I grew up castrating hogs on an Iowa farm. So when I get to Washington, I'll know how to cut pork.
Joni Ernst, mother, soldier, conservative.
My parents taught us to live within our means. It's time to force Washington to do the same.
So she gets a huge job, not to mention the fact that Iowa is the place where presidents have to travel through. But all of us remember the great moments when the Tea Party responds from Michelle Bachmann. She's looking at the wrong camera. Marco Rubio reaches for a bottle of water. Bobby Jindal looked like a hostage during his response. Has there ever been an applauded, well-received response from the party out of power?
Look, you didn't mention Kathy McMorris Rogers, who delivered last year. And
yeah.
I guess she wins because you didn't mention her.
I forgot about her,
remember,
right?
Yeah, because you don't remember anything horrible that happened, she wins. And I think that's unfortunately the standard. Look, this is an incredibly thankless job. Whether the president is a Democrat or a Republican, whether the president is a great communicator or not, the president has a stage for about an hour. It's a live audience. There's great theater, as you said, you know, the jack-in-the-box moments and the looking around and, you know, what are they, you know, make sure in President Clinton's case, make sure the right speech is in the teleprompter. I mean, you have this great theater and a live audience, and then the responder, again, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, Christy Whitman tried it once in the New Jersey legislative chamber with people there, but normally they're in a room with no audience except somebody there cueing them to go to the camera, and they get, you know, a few minutes, and they have to, it's just a horrible, thankless part of the tradition. I think when you play the old Joni Ernst ad, though, she was in a competitive primary at the time when she ran that castration ad. And it broke her, helped break her out from the field. We're not going to hear her say castration tonight.
Too bad, right?
But at the end, trust me, every man in Washington winces when she comes down the hall. You go the other way. But the part at the end where she said, you know, I'm a mother, and Washington is not the answer, and Washington has to live within its means, that is what she's going to say tonight. She's going to say that I'm here in Washington from a state President Obama won twice, because the American people want things different, and they want us to be careful about the purse strings. And yes, they want our help, but they don't want Washington spending or Washington rules. they want our, you know, they want our help. And that is the ideological divide between the president and the Republican Party. And so I look forward to what she has to say.
So do I.
It's a horribly thankless job. But she's become a star almost instantly because she's a female Republican senator, because she's from the state of Iowa, because of her, she proved herself to be a pretty good politician. And she, you know, and obviously every Republican who wants to be president, you know, wants her to be his or her best friend. So she's fun to watch.
You know, John, we spent a lot of yesterday with almost every guest talking about somebody you know quite well, former longtime senator from Massachusetts, now Secretary of State. And the moment we were last week we were talking about the major faux pas the United States made by not sending someone to that huge rally in Paris. And then, of course, about a week later, Senator Curry travels to France to, one, hold hands with the French president, which he did, and then to have James Taylor, who he had in tow, sing "You Got a Friend" as John Kerry mouthed the words along. It was the cause for, I guess, a little bit of friendly ridicule yesterday. What was the talk in Washington about that in very odd set of moments?
I guess to be catty, you know, where was Carly Simon to come out and sing "You're So Vain"? that would be wrong.
We didn't think of that, unfortunately.
Erase that from the record. Look, it was bizarre. And if it went over well with the French, then, you know, God bless Secretary Kerry. People in Washington, when you started asking about it, people literally would think, when you said, "Did you see that?" they would say, "You're joking, right?" That didn't actually happen, did it? We played the video a lot. James Taylor got a lot of TV time on everybody's network, I think, because you had to prove that it actually happened. I found it to be odd, and I found it to be bizarre. Secretary Kerry and his folks say, you know, that apologies accepted on the French end and that things will be fine. He's sometimes a strange character, Secretary is, and he thought this was a good one, and okay.
Do we know yet? I mean, have you or your colleagues found out yet who was the provider of the bad advice to the president or his people about that rally of two Sundays ago? Or do we still not know whether it's Rice or Curry or whomever?
I can't tell you that I have a good TikTok that says, you know, the buck stops here at either the State Department or within the White House and the National Security Council. I do think that in both shops, there is a recognition that they dropped the ball. And that somehow, you know, there was a failure to communicate and a failure to adapt as the event grew in stature.
You know, John King from CNN, we talk to you a little bit about sports every week and
hometown sports.
Yeah, hometown sports. Kevin Cullen, a columnist for the Boston Globe, had a great piece in the paper today talking about not just Deflategate, you know, the argument. We're going to talk about this with our listeners later in the show. The allegations that the Patriots were softening the balls to make them footballs to make them easier to throw and catch and stuff, but that outside of Boston, we're all rooting for the Patriots in Super Bowl here. They are hated. People hate the Patriots. They hate Bill Belichick. They hate Tom Brady. They really can't stand Gisele Bündchen. There's all this. We hate these people. Do you get that sense down in D.C.? I mean, your buddies that are not Bostonians, are they out to sink the Patriots big time?
There's a lot of that. If you folks haven't seen this, go online and look at the New York newspapers today, the tabloids. They all call Bill Belichick a cheater, and they're all four of them, the Newsday, the Daily News, the Post. They're all over. It's crazy. I have a colleague who works with me, one of the producers of my morning show segment, is a Ravens fan, and she's still not over it, and I keep shaking my head. I was, by the way, in section 316, way up there at Foxborough. It was cold and wet and beautiful.
Were you on Sunday night?
I was. A buddy of mine, who a former AP colleague of mine who now lives in Texas, called during the week and he said, "I don't care, we're going." And he got tickets and we went and we had a blast. I took my older son and daughter and he had his son with him, and we just had a great time. It was the wheat, hops, and barley growers of America are in good standing for a couple of weeks.
Oh, that's good. That's good. How wet did you get? Was it really soaking?
We actually got really lucky, if you think about it. It was supposed to rain all day. It was supposed to rain literally all day. And we were outside for 3 hours beforehand tailgating, and it rained the whole second half.
Yeah.
It rained a little bit in the first half, and it rained most of the second half. And but it wasn't as cold as it could have been either.
Good.
I mean, I wish it were snow. It would have been great.
Yeah, but very romantic.
Look, let the NFL investigate. We'll see what happens here. But both teams, I think, played with the same balls. And this part of this is, you know, I've been reading all the commentary about this and how much of it is deflated egos on the Indianapolis part or how much of it is this, how much is that. I sure hope that nobody on the Patriots staff thought they were being cute and did that. But they would have won that game. I mean, the way Indianapolis played, they would have won that game if they were, you know, playing with a soccer ball.
Well, we're going to give you a week, John. You're going to have a week because obviously there's a 2-week hiatus. We're going to give you till next, what day is today? Tuesday, to make your prediction. Are you ready for that?
Yeah, I'm ready. It's going to be a tough one. Seattle's a young, physical, strong team, but let's go get them.
And do you think everybody is hoping that Gronkowski picks up that defensive back for the Seahawks and deposits him on the sideline? Is that's something you're hoping too, right?
I want to win the game in a classy way.
Sure you
that's
do.
What I want to do.
Okay.
You know, before
I
John,
what?
In a big way, fine, but a classy way.
Yeah, before John King goes, you won't know this story, John, but for listeners here in Boston, we're not sure if they're actually going to go, but a local family has been invited to go down to the White House for the State of the Union address, the Henry family. And
DJ Henry.
DJ Henry
Dan
was
and
a young
Henry.
A young black kid, football player at Pace University, who was killed a few years ago by a white police officer. No
in
indictment.
New York, yeah.
A terrible, terrible story. And the Massachusetts delegation invited him to go because they'd been so frustrated with the slowness of the Department of Justice investigation. So we're not sure if they're actually going. They have been invited. But if you see them on TV tonight, the family of DJ Henry, they might be down there as guests of our Massachusetts delegation at the State of the Union, which is pretty neat.
Well, as a hometown boy, you should also, if you see him, say hello. Two of the finest people and one of the finest families I have ever
and the,
met. John.
And the injustice that they have had no resolution to this very suspicious case, if you ask me, of their son being killed. No indictment and not. And worse than that, actually, the police officer who shot him was made police officer of the year following
by the police
the year
union down
he
there,
was
yeah.
killed. Yeah, so it's just terrible.
Well, I'll tell our guys on the Hill, the spotters, to keep an eye out for them.
Yeah, they're great. They're a wonderful family, and it's a sad story, but it's worth keeping going. John, thank you so much for being with us.
I love that he was at the game. See you, John. We'll talk to you next week.
John King is CNN's chief national correspondent and the host of Inside Politics, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 8:30. Okay, coming up, the homeless population in Massachusetts is rising faster than in any other state. We're going to talk with Deborah Hughes, a woman who has devoted her career to getting families off the street and into housing for good. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She's Marjorie Egan. Today, there are approximately 20,000 people living in Massachusetts who don't have a home. This means there are families who are doubled up in motel rooms. It means that someone will be sleeping in his or her car tonight, or worse, spending the night outside. We're one of the few states where homelessness rates are actually going up. It's so bad that shortly after he won the election, then-Governor-elect Charlie Baker said he was committed to getting every family out of motels and hotels and into stable living situations as soon as possible. Here with us in Studio 3 is someone who's been doing this kind of work for years and years, and she knows what it takes. I didn't mean that as a criticism. I meant that as praise, Deborah. Deborah Hughes is the CEO of Brookview House. It's a Dorchester residence for homeless women and their kids. She was recently awarded the BB Change Award, which recognizes a woman committed to improving her community. Deborah, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for being here.
Good morning.
She's not only done it for years. I read this morning you haven't taken a vacation since 2005.
Has it been that long?
Yeah, that's what I read.
She considers this a vacation.
So, Deborah, let's start with why is this happening? You deal with moms and their kids, homeless families. So why are we having we know the rents are up. That's obviously a big reason. But is there something else going on besides rent increasing that's causing all this terrible problem with women and their families to have no place to live?
I think the most important thing is Massachusetts is a very expensive state in which to live. It's not just the rents and the housing. It's the utility costs. It's food costs. It's all the retail stuff you have to buy. It's a very expensive place to live.
And how come they're not living with their families? How come grandma's not taking them in or cousin isn't taking them in? You read these terrible stories about people sleeping on beaches and going to the emergency room at Boston Medical Center because they can't even get into a shelter. How come somebody can't step in for them?
Because the families that we know who, once they come to us, we find out they've already lived with everybody they know. by the time they get to, people don't just say, I don't have a place to live, I'm going to go get into shelter. People have been homeless for a long time before they make that decision, and they've lived with family, they've lived with friends, and they finally run out of people to live with. And you can't stay long because you get your housing jeopardized because you have too many people in the apartment or the unit. So you just move from place to place to place until you absolutely run out of places to go.
So Deborah, I'm sorry, Margaret.
I was just going to say, so if you're in public housing, say, and you're supposed to, and you get a lease for three people, and you've got your daughter and her three kids, you're in violation, you could get thrown out.
Most definitely.
Okay. All right.
And we're talking to Deborah Hughes. Deborah, my sense, and I hope you're going to disabuse me of this, is despite the fact I think it was great, even if people don't like his solution, we'll talk about it in a few minutes, the fact that the governor-elect right away is talking about this issue I think is a real positive thing. My assessment is that people don't care much about this anymore, is that there are issues of poverty that become vogue in a particular period. And I know this sounds really crass, but it is how I feel, that homelessness sort of had its time. And the public has moved on to other issues that affect poor people, or maybe no issues that affect poor people, because they're feeling enough of a pinch themselves. Am I wrong about that? I hope you can disabuse me of that. Am I wrong?
I'm hoping you're wrong. I think family homelessness is now on the agenda for the new mayor. It's on the agenda for the governor-elect. And people are beginning to talk about it because it's also associated with the big issue of poverty. And I think the poverty conversation also relates to the homelessness.
Yeah, but nobody, I mean, except for when Mitt Romney the other day said, I'm thinking of running again, and one of the issues I'm going to run on is poverty. I almost like spit out my coffee. and I didn't mean that as a criticism of Romney, like it sounds. Everybody can embrace whatever they want. It's like, when was the last time you heard any top-level politician talk about poor people? It's working families. I know a lot of poor people are working, but it's working families. It's the middle class. It's middle class working families. It's great that Baker and Walsh are embracing this, but poverty is not on many people's legislators' agendas here or elsewhere, is it?
Okay, you got me.
Okay. It's true, right?
Yeah, it's true.
That because we're so, because of, you know, the economy's getting better? Is it because when people are worried about their own economic well-being, it's hard to be worried about somebody else's? What do you think is the reason?
It's definitely hard to worry about somebody else when you're holding on by your fingertips. So it's really hard to think about folks that have even less than you. You know, but one thing I've learned is no matter how bad you have it, somebody else has it worse. And homeless families are the people who have it worse. And the problem that people have about homeless families is they don't know how to solve the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so they sort of, you know, it's easy to solve the problem of individual homelessness because you have one person that you have to accommodate, one person you can fix. But with the families are complex. And you really have to take a look at the whole family and each individual in the family. And you have to address all of their needs. And that becomes the thing that becomes, people start saying, I can't figure it out.
Yeah.
It's too much. It's too much to do.
We're talking with Deborah Yu. She's the CEO of Brookview House of Residence for Homeless Women and Their Kids. So tell us those kinds of problems. The women you see who are presumably mostly young women, because they got maybe you see older women too, but I get the sense there's a lot of young women with kids. So what are their problems? No education, no money, obviously. What are their problems?
It's Boston and Massachusetts have two types of work economies. One is your high skill, high level, high tech sort of skills that are needed for jobs. And Boston and Massachusetts are also service economies. So those are the low skills, low wage, no benefits, those types of jobs. And those are the people that we see.
Okay.
Some of them are working. Some of them need additional skills, additional training. So those are the types of people who end up in homeless shelters. They might have lost their job. They might be working part-time. That's the families that we see.
And what can you do for them in Brookview? Because you've had a lot of success stories.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do for them?
At Brookview, what we do is, as I talked about, we address each individual in the family. So people come in, they have a whole assessment, each, including the kids. We take a two-generation approach. And I think that's one way of preventing homelessness is, in the future, is working with the children as well. So we also work with the children, work with the schools, work with the moms, help them get skills, get them into education, get them into job training, get them stabilized, but also getting their children stabilized.
So, why do these people trust you? I mean, obviously you have a record of success, and there was a terrific piece about you in the Globe recently, which I assume a lot of people have seen. But the average person coming to you who's in tough straits hasn't read that stuff, hasn't heard of your reputation. Why do they trust you when virtually every institution from government on down has let them down in their lives?
To be honest with you, when they first come, they don't trust
us. They don't
us.
Really?
No.
So how do you build that? What do you do that gets you through that that transition?
It takes time. It takes patience. We have to let them know we care. We have to help them set their goals. We have to work side by side with them. We have to listen to them. We have to hear what their issues are, what their problems are. And we have to hear the fact that nobody before ever listened to them or helped accommodate them.
Tell us, you know, when people listen to things like this, and we say, Marjorie said a minute ago, you've had a record of great success, which you have. Tell us about a family as best you can, and if you can't identify them by name, that's fine too. Tell us about some of the a situation or two where you have helped with their assistance rescue someone from this kind of pain and to live a good life.
We've had a classic example of a family is a family that came in with five children. She was a divorced mom. Once she got divorced, she started living with a mom. Her mom passed, and she came to. She was working.
How old was she?
She was probably about 30. Okay. I would say at the time, and she lost her job, which her mom passed. She lost her job, and then she had to. She lost her housing because she had no ability to. She was working in retail, which is fairly minimum wage.
Sure.
Yeah. No benefits.
And no child care, I would imagine, too. That's another big problem. I mean, you can't, what are you going to do with the kids while you're at work?
Exactly. Yeah.
And so what'd you do?
She came into the program and...
By the way, before she came into the program, I mean, I'm reading all these stories in the Globe about people having to prove that they can qualify even for shelters or a program like yours. As I mentioned before, some of these women are spending the night in cars and on beaches, not in this weather, I hope, but in the emergency room at Boston Medical Center because it's cold out and they have no place to go. Yeah. So even to get to your program is quite an achievement. I mean, the story in the Globe talked about there being, I think, 15 to 20 people a month in Boston Medical Center hanging out there because they have no place else to go with their kids at night in the emergency room. Yes. So that's swell, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a place you can go and they won't kick you out because you're in an emergency room.
Right.
You know, you pretend your kid is sick and you're waiting for the doctor.
So tell us about the mother and the five kids.
What we did is we provided her with assistance, helped her get into training, helped all her stabilize all of her children.
Wait a minute. So when you're getting her help and assistance, the children are living at Brookview House and going to school?
Yes. Brookview, we have apartment-style living. So the family has a full apartment. They have their own kitchen, their own bath. They have two or three bedrooms so that they can truly be stabilized. And they also get to practice the skills they need when they move into permanent housing, because this is what permanent housing looks
like. And mom is getting the skills at Brookview House, so she doesn't have to go off and leave the kids someplace else when they get out of school.
Well, we have after-school programs as well as full-day summer programs.
Okay.
We have teen programs. So we have a full set of programs for the kids as well. So mom can go to school, can get job training during the day and not have to worry about where the kids are after 2 o'clock, after 3 o'clock, because the kids come directly to our programs.
What's the status of that family?
The family is currently, the mom is working full-time, doing very well. The oldest daughter is working as well. She's now in her 20s. She went to college, junior college, for a couple of years. The other kids are, one is a Red Sox scholar.
What does that mean?
Meaning she's in a program funded by the Red Sox where she's being tutored and mentored. She wants to be a doctor.
That's great.
One student is the president of senior class.
So
they're doing very well.
So how long did this take? I mean, this couldn't have taken 2 weeks.
Oh, no.
So how long did this take?
Well, people at Brookview average about living there about 18 months.
Yeah.
But we also continue, which is why the youth programs are perfect. The kids stay in the youth program until they graduate high school. So we attach the family for as long as they need to be.
Deborah, in a minute, we want to talk more about you after we take a break. But before, what's your stress level? I mean, this is, I'm serious. I mean, you have a beautiful smile. You seem totally relaxed talking about, so how do you deal with this? I mean, I'm serious. I mean, obviously you're doing wonderful things, but you're also dealing with great crises with people. How do you, yeah. What have you been, 25 years you've been doing this at Brookview? Isn't that what it is? Quarter of a century?
I thought you were going to say I'm 25 years
old. Yeah, exactly. Give or take. So
we
a quarter of a century.
Only 30.
30, yeah.
How do you deal with this as a person? I mean, that's hard, right?
It's very difficult. And the thing that's most difficult is when forces tell the families that they have to live in a place unfit for human habitation. That becomes difficult for me to deal with. But I'm surrounded by a team of very strong women, very supportive. They guide me, support me, push me.
What happens when a family comes and you know you can help them? And you know, but unfortunately, because of limited resources, and we want to talk about that in a couple of seconds, you say, I can't do this right now. What do you do with that family? What do you do with that rejection? What do you do?
Oh, we never give up.
You never give up, but you may not be able to take someone right away. So, I mean, you keep relentlessly at it until you can.
Yeah.
How long is your waiting list?
We don't have a waiting list. On any given day, if somebody shows up at it's the old welfare office, which is now Department of Housing and Community Development, they have to be placed somewhere. So if we have a vacancy that day, somebody immediately comes in.
Okay.
So we don't keep a waiting list. It's just when we have when somebody moves into permanent housing, somebody that day moves in.
But you've got to be unusual, because if there were 100 Brookview houses, we wouldn't have 20,000 people in this homeless mess. So
exactly,
you are unusual.
Exactly.
And you get you got to do a lot of fundraising to keep in business.
Definitely.
Yeah.
A lot.
What, 40% of your budget is from private funds,
private,
right?
Private funding. Yes.
Okay. I keep you busy, trying to find people the places to live, get them jobs, get them first month, last month, and then raise money to keep the place going.
It's interesting. We're worked into a panic, and we're not even doing it. So it's just really.
We're talking to Deborah Hughes about homelessness and what it takes to get families off the street. She's the CEO of Brookview House, Residence for Homeless Women and Children. I'm going to ask her more about how she got into this when that conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. If you just joined us, we're talking about homelessness in Massachusetts, growing faster here than anywhere in the country. We have approximately 20,000 people in the state who don't have a home. Our guest Deborah Hughes knows something about it, a lot about it, what it takes to get families into stable homes for good. She's CEO of Brookview House, which is a residence for homeless women and their kids. Deborah, Charlie Baker, early on, he writes an op-ed somewhere, I forget where it ran, the new governor, obviously, spoken a lot about reducing to zero the number of homeless people in hotels and motels. He's gotten a lot of praise from some quarters. Other people are saying, you don't get the whole picture. It's not just about hotels and motels. It's about poverty and having enough food and all this sort of stuff. What's your sense of Baker's plan?
reducing the number to zero would be ideal. From hotels and motels, it's been done in the past, but the numbers weren't as high. So I think at this point in time, they have to look at the whole big picture. And I think it's important for the governor to think about a plan that's not a one-size-fits-all kind of plan.
What does that mean?
Generally, what happens with the public entities is they decide, this is what we're going to do for homeless families. And every homeless family is going to fit into that model, that shoe, that box. When homeless families have a multitude of issues that have to be addressed, you can't just say everybody is going to be placed into this temporary housing place and it's going to fit, because people are homeless for any number of reasons. In the past, they were called tiers, tier one through tier four. Tier one were people like who were homeless because of a fire or something. They always had stable housing, always permanent. Mm-hmm. They just need to be placed in housing immediately. But then you have the other two, three, four tiers. Where it's more chronic. People are homeless for long periods of time.
Have you met with him or any of his people since he... I know he's only been there for a month. Have you spoken to any people in his administration?
Not yet, but I hope to speak with them soon.
Yeah, we do too.
So, Deborah Hughes, what do you think the misconceptions are? I think a lot of people think of homeless people, they think of the guy that's hitting them up for money in the corner and, you know, looking for a buck. What do you know that we don't about the women that you see and their kids?
Homeless families are invisible. Yeah. I think that's the thing that allows them to be marginalized, is because they're invisible. You might be at South Station mm-hmm. and see your mom and her kids sitting there. They look like they're waiting for the bus, go to New York, mm-hmm. go to, you know, Texas or something. They might be living there for the night because that's the only place they have to go. You know, so that's the invisibility piece is what allows the homeless issue for families to grow and to escalate.
What caused you to do this? I mean, I've read about it, but most people haven't. What caused you to decide, well, I'm going to spend most of my adult life helping homeless women and their kids? Why'd you do this?
I think I'm just drawn to working on women's issues. Went to all girls middle school, went to a girls high school, went to a women's college.
Wellesley College. La di da.
Callie Crossley is probably listening with her fist
yeah,
pumped in the
went,
air.
Hi, Callie. Yeah. We lived in the same dorm.
Oh, did is that true?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. So yeah. But there's got to be something more. Something had to happen in your life. That, I mean, was there something other than your concern for your fellow women?
I think it's also the way I was raised, the way my mom treated everybody. I mean, the way we were raised is if somebody had a problem at home or they ran away from home, they could come live at our house, you know, and then my mom would have to call their parents, you know, tell them where they were and fix it. But if somebody also came up from the South and needed a place to stay, they could stay at our house.
So you were like a mini Brookview house before there was a – I'm serious. Before there was a Brookview house.
Yeah, yeah.
But we don't do that anymore. I mean, very few people do that anymore. So what happened?
The culture has changed. And I don't know what it is in the culture that changed. And I haven't been able to pinpoint that. It's kind of like part of the culture says everybody should have their own individual sort of place to stay, place to live, and – you know, be independent and be on their own. Where in the past, it was always supportive and everybody came together.
So you mentioned that woman before with the five kids that came in and she got divorced and she lost her place to live after her mother died. So, I mean, to go from there to working full time with her kid, the Red Sox scholar, and one going to college and la-di-da-di-da, she's obviously done like a 180-degree turn from this terrible place she was at. So that means that she was always able to do it. She just didn't have... What?
The supports and the assistance and the mentoring and the coaching and the nurturing that women need.
Why didn't she have it?
Because it's like I said earlier, where you've gone from place to place, friend to friend to friend, and eventually people don't have anything else to support you with or to help you.
You know, one of my favorite, how horrible is it to be smiling, saying my favorite story about homelessness? I feel like a fool for having said this, but let me try to recast it. You know, there was a great story. Marjorie and I have talked about this a lot. A couple of years ago, there was a story, I think in the Boston Globe, maybe it was your old paper, about how right before Thanksgiving, everybody called the Pine Street Inn and wanted to volunteer to help serve meals on Thanksgiving. And the people at the Pine Street Inn very nicely said, we're full. There are 364 other days of the year. Can you pick one of those days? And we'd be love to help you. And a stunning number of people said, no, I'm only interested in helping on Thanksgiving. It's sort of like that's when you help homeless people. The other 364 days, you do whatever it is you do. Right. So for people, I mean, obviously, if someone wants to write a check, brookviewhouse.org, we understand, learn more about your organization. What can the average person who actually does care about this issue What can they do?
We need a lot of help at Brookview because we serve about 370 women and children per year. We have a lot of programs. We have workshops where people can come in and they can teach resume writing. They can serve as mentors. They can work with the teens. We have field trips. We have weekend retreats. Mm. We have the full-day summer program, which is like almost like part of it is like school. The other part is recreation and entertainment. So we always need folks to come in and do that. So we need people's time, their talent, and their treasure. And 300, like you said, 365 days a year. Right now we have a Girls Who Code class. We need a couple other volunteers to
help. What's that again?
Girls Who Code, where girls are learning computer science.
Oh, great.
So we need a couple more teachers to help us do that. So there are all types of opportunities around.
We're going to get the website before you go, too. So there's a big domestic violence factor, I would assume. A lot of women that wind up being homeless, they're victims of beatings or victims of sexual violence as well. That's got to be a huge factor. They need some place to get away from the guy.
Yeah, definitely. But we're not clandestine, so this is not the first place you would go. It's not, but we have relationships with domestic violence shelters. But what we find is probably about 90% of the women have been victims of either domestic violence or some type of sexual or physical trauma.
Now, you didn't brag about this, but your aide here just gave me these statistics so we can brag about them for you, that 93% of the mothers that have gone through Brookview House go on to permanent housing. That's a pretty impressive number.
And stay.
And 88% of Brookview students graduate high school. If that student stayed in a shelter or hotel, that would be just 25%. Right. I suspect you have much different rules than some of the shelters, family shelters, you know, I've been a reporter all my life, visit them, that I wouldn't want to live there for 5 minutes. You're doing something different there.
Yeah.
How's it different than a regular family shelter?
What we do that's different is we provide a home.
Yeah.
And that's the common theme that comes from most of the people that live there.
An apartment, you mean?
No, a home.
Okay.
A home, which is different than an apartment. You can give somebody an apartment, but we provide a home. It's a community. It's a place where people support each other. Despite the fact people are living in their own individual apartments, women come together. We have communal chores in the house. We have leadership opportunities for the women in the house. People also support each other. If you have to go somewhere, you know, run an errand or have a meeting at the welfare office or something, and you need somebody to watch one of your kids or something while you're there, then another woman in the house will help you.
So this is like a family.
Yes. Definitely.
What's a great Luther Vandross song? A house is not a home. It's really big. Before you go very quickly, please tell me that most of these people stay in touch with you and at Christmas or something. They do. You're shaking your head. Yes, they do.
Everybody's
you're
graduations.
Far too humble for this job. They do, right?
They do.
I know you get to go to the graduation. You're getting to any weddings yet? Anybody invite you to the weddings?
Actually, not weddings
yet. Not yet. Well, that'll be next, I guess.
Deborah, right. It was really a pleasure talking to you. Wish you a lot of luck. It's terrific what you're doing.
Deborah Hughes is the CEO of Brookview House of Residence for Homeless Women and Children based in Dorchester. She was recently awarded, congratulations, the Be the Change Award, which recognizes a woman committed to improving her community. To learn more about her work and Brookview House, go to brookviewhouse.org. Thank you very much for being with us, Deborah.
Thanks, Deborah.
Up next, I'm going to ask you about a new report that says 1%, that the 1%, I should say, are getting even richer and richer and richer. That's a nice segue from this. Is there any way we can close the wealth gap? We're going to talk about that next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Kicking off the noon hour on today's BPR, on the day we learn the top 1% control 50% of the world's wealth, most think that's a problem, but will they support Barack Obama's cure? We'll ask you.
As he enters his 20th year as conductor of the Boston Pops, Keith Lockhart shares with us his world-famous mashed potato recipe. Then, is the Patriots Deflategate really about soft footballs or more about jealousy of Tom Terrific Brady, Bill Belichick, or anything else or anyone in life so lucky and so stellar it drives you nuts? As jury selection continues in the marathon bombing trial, Dave Wedge and Casey Sherman with their new book on the marathon bombing, then the guys from This Old House. They'll take all your home improvement questions coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hello there, Marjorie. You know, we already... What's that?
Before we move on.
Sure.
I just want to say for those who missed it, what page you are on the Globe today, Jim?
I don't remember. C6.
Cartoon C6. The business section, C6 of the Boston Globe.
Chris Morris from
don't
the Globe,
want to miss it.
An illustrator, did a fetching, as you would say,
hot, very hot, Jim.
Caricature. I think I look pretty hot there,
you look
too.
Pretty hot.
C6, but
yeah.
Who who cares? In any case, we discussed this in part with John King from CNN about an hour ago, but now we're going to discuss it with you. The rich are indeed getting richer. This is a new report out of Oxfam that estimates the richest, this is just staggering, the richest 1% will have as much wealth as the other 99% combined next year, meaning they're hitting the 50% mark. If the Occupy Wall Street movement couldn't do anything to slow down the ever-expanding wealth gap, will the president be able to? Tonight's State of the Union address, he's going to offer solutions. Are they even viable? As you know, he's expected to call for higher taxes on wealthy Americans, some big firms, tax credits for the middle class. Is this enough? And whether it is or not, are you going to tell your legislator, your member of Congress, that you want them to support this? 877-301-8970 is our number. 877-301-8970. Here's my thesis, and it's stolen, sort of, from a guy we quote all the time, and I haven't read the book in ages, What's the Matter with Kansas? It was a piece by this guy, I think it's Thomas Frank, it's somebody Frank, wrote ages ago about why people in America vote against their own economic self-interest. Here's my analysis. A huge percentage of Americans believe that the concentration of wealth in the top 1% is a problem, and an equally huge percentage of Americans won't support any solution to begin to fix it. Now, I'm not suggesting that Barack Obama's, whatever, is $320 billion in new taxes on upper-income people. I think it's a couple making more than $500,000 a year, financial firms with assets over $50 billion. Any of that stuff is going to fix the problem, but it will begin to create a little more balance. My guess is when polls come out tomorrow, they'll be slightly in favor of the president's plan. And once the Republicans attack it for a few days, they'll be in the negative, meaning we know there's a problem, we just don't want to fix it. 877-301-8970. You disagree with that?
No. Well, I think there's going to be – the spin will be just what we talked about. I mentioned it with John King before that, you know, Senator Orrin Hatch will go out and say this is an attack on small businesses, this is an attack on the middle class, this is an attack on mom and pop little stores, which is baloney. It's not at all. It is basically, I always preface this by saying I am not an economist.
I hate when you do this.
I'm sorry, but it's
99% of Americans who are going to decide about this are not economists.
But it's
either.
Fairly obvious that the middle class is disappearing, and you can't have a successful
getting
democracy.
Hammered, as someone
it's getting hammered,
know,
as Elizabeth Warren has put it over and over in her campaign. She's still putting it in Washington, and her messages begin to resonate because the middle class is getting hammered. As we said before, you know, we can lots of us can remember when actually a father could go out to work and support the family, two kids, and have a couple of weeks vacation and go to college and have a halfway decent house and a car. That's like all over with now. We're just talking about homelessness. You know, you can't even afford to get an apartment in Boston. People are selling. Meanwhile, you know, there's a great juxtaposition in downtown Boston where you have St. Francis House, the homeless shelter, and around the corner you have like the $10 million condos. I mean, you know, it's not – my friends always say to me, oh, you're just jealous of rich people. Well, I am jealous of rich people, but that's not really what this is about. This is just about you can't have a successful economy. You can't deal when there's just this huge juxtaposition between the super, super wealthy, the super, super poor, and the middle class.
So why don't people rise up and say we want middle class relief and we want the wealthy to pay a fair share? Why aren't they rising up and doing that?
Well, I think one example, and we talked about this with Michael Norton from Harvard Business School, is that when people talk about what the line worker is getting versus what the CEO is getting, we have no idea that it's as bad as it is. And I think a lot of Americans don't have any idea how the deck is stacked, to steal another line.
Rigged.
Our system is rigged, as Elizabeth Warren said again. I mean, she's hitting it on all cylinders, isn't she? I don't think people are aware of it. They think this is a capitalist country. You should be able to make as much money as you want. And these are all these lefty socialists from Cambridge that are trying to steal money from rich people and give it to poor people. And that's not what it's about. It's about a readjustment. As I said before, when you read that tax loophole thing about the trust fund loophole, that if you inherit money from your parents, there's real no capital gains tax liability the way the system is rigged up now. So you can inherit millions and millions of dollars and pay, well, I shouldn't say pay nothing, but you're not paying very much. You should be paying more.
Remember years ago when GE was making zillions and zillions and zillions of dollars and paying nothing in federal income taxes?
I mean, that's right.
Occasionally there's an aberrational moment where there's such a fiscal atrocity that everybody, well, not everybody, the vast majority of people believe there needs to be a fix. And apparently, I mean, I think this populist thing is growing in popularity, but I'm not sure there's enough. By the way,
here's
Republicans
another
who oppose this, as opposed to the Tea Party people, and I don't mean this as a criticism, they are what they are, they're mostly inflexible. With the exception of the Tea Party, you would think that moderate Republicans would join some Democrats in trying to create greater equity in this society. But my contention is that people are not going to demand it. And since they won't demand it, they won't get it.
Our numbers are 877, our number is, I should say, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What's the matter with Kansas is this discussion? I mean, why is it that people don't rise up and put pressure on the government? I think it's because people just are not paying attention. They're too busy living their lives. They're not paying attention.
Yeah, but can I tell you, you cited the Michael Norton thing, and it was great, as he always is from Harvard Business School, who said people's perception of how big the divide is not nearly as big as it actually is, and that's a pretty simple-minded summary. But they know there's a huge divide. They may not know that the average CEO makes, what does he make, 400 times as much as the average
worker? In some cases,
worker.
It's in the thousands.
Well, whatever it is. They may not know the actual number. Do you know anybody who doesn't know that there's a huge disparity? Nobody doesn't know, to use a double negative, and they have chosen not to act.
Well, I think what they do is lots of times you pick on poor people. You blame the number of people that are getting welfare as if that's somehow the problem. You know what the other great example is? You know, we just went through this horrible recession, and part of the problem is that we had these banks that were too big to fail, and we bailed them out with taxpayer money while people got the shaft on their mortgages and lost their homes and all this predatory lending, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
We just, again, put back the laws that allow banks that are too big to fail to fail again and to be bailed out by taxpayers.
You know who signed that into law, by the way?
Everybody did.
No, who signed it into law?
I think Barack Obama signed it.
Barack Obama, right.
Yeah,
it was the $1 trillion budget thing.
He did.
He signed that change. Elizabeth Warren screamed bloody murder. Steve Lynch did. Some others signed into law by the guy who tonight is. So there's a little bit of political schizophrenia here, too.
Yes, but I guess my question is, why aren't we upset about this? I mean, do you want to have 2007, 2008 come back again?
Let me tell you, because I used to do tax stuff for a living, and I won some and I lost plenty. The reality is the other side on this issue, for lack of a better expression, is far better at a term that I can't stand, messaging, than our side. We've talked about what a horrible job Barack Obama has done in selling the Affordable Care Act. And then when people do find out what some of the contents are, at least the contents they love, at least a lot of people, like there's just a horrible sell job on the part of, I believe, people who are more populist in their economics than those who aren't. 877-301-8970. We've talked enough. Let's go to Taunton, where Mike is on the phone. Mike, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
How are you guys doing?
We're excellent. Thank you for the call.
All right, Jim. You said the Tea Party's inflexible. Let's see how flexible you are.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just watching a video. Thomas Sowell was being interviewed. Marjorie, he happens to be an economist.
Yes, I know he is.
Go ahead.
He wrote a book, The Basic Economics. He just rewrote it. And he pointed out some interesting statistics. And I don't know if they prove anything other than statistics can tell you whatever you'd like.
Of course they can.
But what percentage of people in America do you think are in the top 10% at some point in their lives? Just take a guess, ballpark.
At some point in their lives, what percent of us are in the top 10%? I don't know. 30%. I have no idea either.
He said 56% of Americans will be in the top 10% at some point in their life.
Can I tell you, Mike, whatever it's worth, I didn't read it and I didn't hear him. I find that to be absolutely and totally not believable. I mean, just
he's very conservative.
Yeah, well, conservative or not, there are a lot of conservatives and a lot of liberals who don't play with the facts. But I just find that. So your point is, since so many people are in that situation, if we're not there for a longer period of time, it's our fault, not government policies.
No, it's just a quote he had. People often discuss the poor and the rich as different people, but they are the same people in different stages in their life. And you typically, you know, when you're older and when you've sold all of your, you know, you've made all your money,
yep,
you know, you may qualify for the top 10%.
By the way, even if his numbers are right and whatever you just said, half the people are in the top 10% at one part in their life, my attitude remains the same. Well, they, at that period of time, are able to contribute more. And when they're not in the top 10%, they won't have to contribute more. So why does that undercut the argument, Mike?
Well, if you think that if someone works their entire life while they're contributing, and then in the end of their life, they've, you know, are comfortable and mm-hmm. they have to contribute more, it seems double contributions here. But another interesting thing is the world. If we look at the statistics of the world,
yeah,
okay, the vast majority of people are getting richer. We're all doing very well as the world stands.
We are?
Mike, I missed that report, yeah. I must say. But Mike, thank you. You make good case. Thank you for your call.
I appreciate it. There is just a basic number here. That,
what's that?
That 1% of the world in 2016, that's next year, are going to own 50% of the world's wealth.
Yeah.
So 1% own 50% of the wealth.
It's a lot.
That seems not to be a good figure to me.
Mm. And by the way, let me just say one more thing about it. Mike, I'm glad Mike started this conversation. His basic point being a huge percentage of us are amongst the wealthy Americans at one point or another. I doubt that, but let's assume it's true for argument's sake. The only time they will be asked to do more is when they're in that fortunate position. And the implication is that what Barack Obama or anybody like him is saying is, please give me all of your money. He's not saying give you all of your money. He's saying that you are in a position – a la the Warren Buffett argument where he says he pays at a lower rate than his secretary. It's become a tired old line, but I assume it's true. You are in a position at this point in your life to pay a little bit more to provide for people who are trying to get in that same position. It is not some radical, you know, leftist lunacy. It's the notion that people who can afford to pay more should. 877-301-8970. Why don't you do what we do every time we have this discussion,
what's
Marjorie,
that?
And say what the top rate was when John Kennedy took over as president.
Oh, it was high. It was like 70% or something like that. It was
maybe
really
even
high.
Higher. I think
during World War II, it was 90% of the highest rate. Now,
which no one is. I don't think Barack Obama is advocating for a 90% rate on income taxation.
He's not. He's asking for a higher rate on capital gains to bring it back to where it was when Ronald Reagan was president, which doesn't seem crazy to me because that's the theory that tax policy. And by the way, in one of these stories I was reading for preparing today, part of the reason that things have gotten so out of whack is because lobbyists spend billions and billions of dollars seducing everybody in Washington so that they will vote for to loosen the regulations on financial reform, which is just what happened a couple of weeks
ago. Citibank wrote it. The provision you're talking about was written. They acknowledge it by Citibank.
So again, and I don't see how people don't see this as bad for them. If this happens again, like what happened in 2008, you, the taxpayer, are going to be bailing out Citibank. Doesn't that bother people? I don't get why that doesn't
apparently
bother people.
Apparently not. Let's go to Steve in Freetown. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon, Marjorie and Jim.
And to you.
You know, I have to tell you, this is something that holds true to me, something I think about every day.
Mm-hmm.
With all due respect to President Obama's speech, there is nothing in that that is going to help me or any of my friends.
Is that the end of the sentence?
And we're middle class. And I'll explain to you why.
Okay.
Sure.
I got pushed into this call by my friends today because they're all listening. I'll be honest with you, Jim and Marjorie. My wife and I make between $150,000 and $200,000 a year, okay? So we are what you would consider upper middle class. I have less than 2 months' mortgage payment in the bank. I have $65,000 I owe in student loan debt for my son, $33,000 I owe in student loan debt for my wife, who went back and got her CFE and her master's degree in accounting. None of my vehicles are new. My family, my youngest daughter, has been on 3 vacations. She's soon to be 14 in her entire life. And the only thing that's my saving grace right now is because my wife and I have done everything by the book, okay? My wife and I have done everything by the book. That fuel has come down. And you know what I'm doing with that extra money from fuel? I'm paying down debt.
Hey, Steve, don't go away. By the way, you're a fabulous caller, and I'm glad your friends convinced you to call. How much do you say you and your wife make?
We make between $150,000 and $200,000 a year.
Okay, well, let me tell you two things that are in the president's proposal that you say will have no effect on you. He proposes to increase the top capital gains rate on couples with incomes over $500,000 a year. It's 2.5 times as much as you make. There's no other provision that I'm aware of that would, in terms of increases, that would hit a family in your bracket. On the flip side, let me just finish for a second. He's also proposing an additional tax credit for families in which both spouses work. It would cover 24 million people, and the credit would apply to families with annual incomes up to $210,000. So I would argue, at least as based on what we hear in advance of the speech, the tax increases won't touch you, and the credits and other spending
will help you.
So what? Why are you not? I mean, you're exactly who we wanted to talk to, Steve, and we're thrilled you called. Why would you not support something like that?
Because my wife and I looked into this as deeply as we could with the limited information.
Sure, I understand that.
First of all, Jim, here's what happened. There's 3 nasty letters for people in my category. AMP rate.
That's alternative minimum credit. Yeah, it's really a nightmare. Yep.
Because they are not going to change that. Everything that President Obama puts in is over and above what the AMT rate is. Because AMT kicks in, Jim, we have a piece of income property that my son resides in.
Mm-hmm.
You know that I haven't been in the last 3 years since my wife got a raise because God forbid she became a CFE. Put us into that next tax bracket.
Sure.
We haven't been able to claim $1, Jim, in repairs on income property because we fall in that donut hole. And you know what? I'm a Republican. I'm a conservative Republican. And with all due respect, I have zero faith in either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party.
Steve, that was a great call, and we hope you do it again. And if everybody spent as much time checking things out and had as much passion for policy as you did, we wouldn't be in the mess we're
okay,
in. Steve, thanks for the call.
Mr. Taxman, we don't want to bore people to tears, as you always say, but explain to people, since you are Mr. Taxman, the alternative minimum tax.
It was originally passed. I can't remember the year it was passed, but without giving
was
people
it Clinton?
A headache. It was, I'm not sure, but it was originally passed to make sure that a fair share, or at least something, was paid by an infinitesimally small number of people. It may have been as little, as few as like a couple hundred of the richest people in America. I can't remember. It's something like that. But because Congress has not fixed it, the level of the capture of this tax, which, as Steve did say, causes a lot of people who are upper middle class to lose all their deductions, lose all their stuff, has grown higher and higher and higher. And because the government, Republicans and Democrats, are dependent upon the living, about the income from it, they all complain. They all complain about the AMT, and they never do anything about it.
Okay, but one thing is, I would say that he is not upper middle class in Massachusetts. If you're making $200,000, that's a lot of money, and that used to be a very comfortable income. But when your house is $400,000 and $500,000, your kid's education is $60,000. Massachusetts, that is not – you are not comfortable, which is incredible to say, because you thought, wow, once I make six figures, I'll be on Easy Street. Well, it depends a lot on where you live, and you're not on Easy Street around here.
And by the way, didn't – when Obama proposed taxing the rich, or I'm sure you didn't call it that, or increasing, wasn't it originally at $250,000 and then people went crazy?
Up. Yeah, he went
and
up.
And now the capital gains changes at $500,000. But I'll tell you, the guy had done his homework, and while he obviously disagrees in the policy, he knows a lot about what he's talking about, even though tonight's policies actually would benefit him.
Let's go to Maddie in Arlington. Hi, Maddie.
Hey, Maddie.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
So that last caller was, he projected the apathy that people have for the whole situation.
Well, whoa. One thing he was apathetic.
Passionate. He was passionate.
No, I mean the apathy that people have towards taxes. No. I mean, he was dead on. I enjoyed his call very much.
Yeah.
Number one, I think that flat tax, I don't understand why we talk about it, but we never really get into it. And if it was fair, then why do people that have money pay people to hide their money?
Well, first of all, the flat tax, as people know, I can't believe we're getting into all this, but since you brought up, we have it in Massachusetts. We actually asked Charlie Baker about it the other day when he was here, the new governor. He likes keeping it that way. The vast majority of states and the federal government have a graduated income tax, which does ask people to pay at a higher rate. But your view, Maddie, is a flat tax is a better system, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the way the taxes, when April 15th comes, most people are pulling their hair out because the rules change.
Yeah, but let me interrupt you to say, what you're talking, with all due respect, I think you want a simpler tax system, which every sane person in America would want. The problem with the flat tax, without giving people too much of a headache, and Steve Forbes, when he's running for president, supported this thing, he probably still does, is the average lower middle income family, 5% of their income is a real strain. They spend every penny that they have and then some. 5% of a wealthy person's income is a piece of cake. So not basing an income tax on ability to pay, a lot of people, me included, thinks is inequitable. But Maddie, thanks for the call. Margo, you're in Oxford. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Margo.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
Good. Thanks for taking my call. I called to agree with Jim about a point.
That's a first.
But first wanted to say that the caller before this last one, I would agree with Marjorie that I don't think in this day and age that anything under $200,000 is considered upper middle class anymore. It just
well, not in Massachusetts. You might get a long way in Arkansas, but not around here.
Exactly. I live in New Hampshire, but I'm in Oxford right now. But anyway, I agree with you on that point. But Jim, previously you said that you think some of the issue might be messaging. that the message is not getting out there, and why do people vote against their own self-interest? Mm-hmm. And I work in human services here in Mass. I live in New Hampshire. I work with lower-income people. And you are 100% right. I mean, it's astounding to me how many of my clients who struggle and are on social service programs and have trouble finding housing, and, I mean, every day is a struggle for them, are, if they're voting at all, they're voting Republican. And, you know, they're just, I don't think the Democrats are doing a great job of getting out the message on why people need to vote a little bit differently and how they can be helped by voting for the right candidate.
Well, the best example, Margot, Republican, Democrat, putting it aside just for a second, we mentioned it a minute ago, the best example in the last handful of years is the Affordable Care Act. The vast majority of people do not like the Affordable Care Act. And then when you go down the provisions, you can keep your kid on your own policy till they're 26. Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
They can't bar me from coverage because of a pre-existing condition. Oh, I love that too. You know, it leads to the best, I think, funniest political video of the last few years is when Jimmy Kimmel sent his reporter out to Hollywood Boulevard in California and asked him to ask people who were walking by, which do you prefer, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare? And I think you know the end of the story. Everybody preferred the Affordable Care Act. Nobody liked Obamacare, even though they're the exact same thing, which I think speaks to the fact that the proponents of such things don't know how to sell their product. Margot, thank you so much for the call, though.
Ryan just emailed and said if Obama was really serious about this, he wouldn't keep staffing his office with former Wall Street executives.
By the way, I think that's
a very good point.
Well, how about Tim Geithner not paying his taxes? And remember that story?
I know. It was
Secretary
unbelievable.
Secretary of the Treasury.
Okay, enough of that. We're going to be joined when we come back next by Keith Lockhart, the Pops conductor. He's going to, in his 20th year of his conductor, is conducting the Boston Pops, I should say. He joins us when his schedule permits, and he's here today to learn more about the Boston Pops and upcoming events. We'll tell you about that when he gets in here. Next, coming up, Keith Lockhart.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brady and Marjorie. You know, working at GBH, you see a lot of interesting people wandering the halls. In recent times, Yo-Yo Ma, John Lithgow, Gina Davis. Keith Lockhart is another one of these people. We're not sure what brings him to GBH's hallways today. Maybe trying to get a bootleg edition of Downton Abbey Season 6. I can help you out, Keith. Maybe he got disoriented at that martini lunch at the Stalker. Whatever it is, we're thrilled whenever he stops by, even though he should be practicing for the 2024 opening ceremony. Keith Lockhart, it is great to see you. How are you, Keith?
Oh, I'm great. And, you know, I was just wandering aimlessly, and you guys took pity on me and let me in.
That's right. You know what I can't believe? I can't believe, I mean, you are a very youthful-looking guy.
As are you.
Thank you very much. I can't believe you've been conducting the BSO. This is going to be the 20th year.
This is my 20th anniversary season, so it's actually my 21st season.
21st season.
Now, weird.
Huh? I was looking this morning. John Williams was here for 13 years. Mm-hmm. Arthur Fiedler, who preceded him, was here for 50 years.
I haven't even made it halfway yet.
Yeah.
Nor do I intend to.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a long time. Is that typical for what you do, or is that unusual?
No, it's very unusual, and it's arguable that a 50-year tenure would just never happen in the current climb. And, you know, I can't imagine that there's anything you could do for that period of time that would be good either for you or for the organization you were doing it to. Nonetheless, it's, you know, when I came here in 95, I knew it was a long-term commitment. I just didn't know how long-term that was, but it's wonderful to still be in a place and still feel like I've got something to contribute two decades in.
But what was your expectation? When you came here in 95, when you said a long-term commitment, did you ever say to yourself, I'm going to do this for 10 years? What did you say when you were the young Keith Lockhart?
In your mind's eye, you always think, you know, what's going to be after this? Because when you're young, when you're 35, you're not going, well, I'll do this for, you know. And sure enough, I didn't really know. I mean, I had, you know, what's going to happen after the Boston Pops is an interesting question. It is, you know, it's kind of a terminal job. I mean, you get here and it's a wonderful situation. And within this branch of the classical music business, there's nowhere to go that could compare.
You know, when I look at you, you know, we're going to talk later in the show, Keith Lockhart, and I was looking at you with admiration about 10 seconds ago while you were speaking.
Shucks.
Later in the show, we're going to talk about the jealousy directed at the Patriots, Brady, Belichick.
Deflate a gate.
I have never heard one person say an unkind word about you. I'm serious.
I have.
Have you really? I'm serious. You are one of those. It's a weird, but you are this beloved character in the city who I assume has warts that we're not aware of. But that is strange. You feel that, do you not?
I do, and it feels almost like it's a guilty pleasure. It's about that I'm associated with such a wonderful thing. Yeah. I mean, if you're a politician, no matter how good you are, you're going to be besmirched by the environment you inhabit. But the great thing is, I'm associated, you know, completely with an organization that people don't have bad things to say about. So yeah. I'm very lucky that way.
You know, it's true. There haven't really been any scandals of the first violinist running off with the French horn player that we know about.
Let's not go there.
Okay. Well, we won't talk about those anyway.
What happens in Symphony Hall stays in Symphony Hall.
But Keith Lockhart, you are doing this five-tour thing in five-city tour. Oh, before I get to that, though, let me think about I was going to ask you more important. Are you unique? Is the Boston Pops unique? Is there a Pops in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Minnesota or anything?
The Boston Pops was the first of its kind, and the first of its kind by a good 75 years or so. In the 1970s, a number of organizations started their own Pops traditions within them or separately. For instance, the Philly Pops is a separate organization from the Philadelphia Orchestra. The Cincinnati Pops, where I was before I came to Boston in 95, is part of the Cincinnati Symphony. Those were all sprung up basically as imitators of the Boston Pops model.
Huh. So tell me about this five-city tour thing you're doing. Well-timed in February in Florida.
Well,
Where do you go?
We're bright that way. Biannually now, we go down to Florida and sometimes to a larger swath of the Southeast to play a week or two of concerts. It's not a bad place to go in February if you're leaving Boston to go there.
Yeah.
And also, we have obviously a lot of supporters down there and a lot of snowbirds who come down. Every time we go down to West Palm, we do two concerts in West Palm at the Kravitz Center. This time we're in Sarasota, where we often are, Tampa, Fort Lauderdale, and one other one, which is escaping me on the moment.
Inside or outside?
All inside. We have done outside concerts there before. It's great to be able to do an outside concert in February, but one of the last times we did a huge concert for 10,000 people in Vero Beach, which had a rain squall you wouldn't have believed come in the middle of it. So I like the concert hall experience.
We're talking to Keith Lockhart, a voice I'm sure you recognize, obviously. He of the Boston Pops. How many people travel when you go to Florida or wherever else you're talking about?
All told, 85, that sort of range.
Is that – I know you don't have to deal with the logistics, but it is – is that like
it's like a military operation.
Nightmare? It is it not?
It's even more so in the past, our long holiday tours that involved a couple of weeks and a chorus as well. So we had about 150 people on the road. It also makes it more difficult for us to get out and see the fans these days because, fees for these concerts are about the same as they were when I started. Very little difference. And the cost of airfare and trying to get an orchestra down there has gone up like sixfold or something like that.
You know, speaking of what I asked you a minute ago about no one ever criticizing you, do the people who play for you like you? No, I'm serious.
What, are they going to tell the conductor that he's a jerk?
Do they like you? I mean,
I hope at the least that they respect me. There are, you know, it's like any other work situation. You try to be a good boss. You try to be a fair boss. It is a position that is kind of set up for an antagonistic relationship. But I think we've moved beyond that. And I like to think that there's nobody in there that actively dislikes me.
If they have a problem, I mean, you know, every boss who has ever lived says my door is always open, even if they don't mean it. Do people feel, the people who play for you, do they feel if they've got a problem, you're an approach? I mean this sincerely, that Keith Lockhart is an approachable person who will listen to me and hear me out and that sort of thing?
I think so. I mean, it's possible to play the maestro card a lot of different ways. And historically, one of the ways is to kind of cosset yourself behind your people. You know, have gatekeepers and say, well, you know,
that's exactly what I meant.
And I've tried very hard not to do that because it's just not me. It just doesn't fit comfortably. So what I've tried to do is be somebody who is on the same side all the way through and the people feel they can talk to. How well I've succeeded, you'll have to ask them.
Okay. We're talking with Keith Lockhart, who's entering his 21st year as conductor of the Boston Pops. You guys have never played in a Super Bowl, have you? Or have
we
you?
Have.
You have?
Have you?
I did not know that.
I can't believe you were asking that question.
Where did you play?
The first one.
Really?
Well, not the the first Super Bowl, but the first 2002 Super Bowl in New Orleans.
What was that like?
It was amazing. I'll tell you that people always assume that that was something that the Patriots or Mr. Kraft arranged.
I did.
When we were asked to do this, the Patriots were something like 3-4. It was the early part of the season. This was the Super Bowl right after 9/11.
Yes.
And it was a huge change, the security, all these things that we didn't quite know what we were grappling with. But Fox Sports and the NFL asked us because they wanted, as opposed to the often kind of flavor of the month pop thing that is up there, they really wanted something that was very grounded and American and
yeah.
a little bit patriotic. And they asked us, at the same time they asked, well, not American, but you too. And
I remember that.
And
the screen
Paul McCartney
was,
as well.
Yeah.
It was, yeah, when they did the victims. Yeah. And so we were on the pre-show with Paul McCartney.
So where do you wait to play? Are you in some kind of basement bowel of this big stadium or what?
That was, we were placed there before that. Afterwards, I got to watch the game in an NFL box. The people sitting next to me were Patti LaBelle on one side and Don Shula and Joe Namath on the other side.
As
a kid who grew up in
God.
New York in the 60s, having Broadway Joe sitting next to me was very, very
so
cool.
So do you get nervous?
Hold on.
You're going to ask if Joe Namath asked to kiss him?
I just want to ask, I remember Joe Namath when he predicted he was going to win the Super Bowl, and that was the first American League team to go against a National League team. And Nobody thought they had a chance. I thought that was so brash on his part. What was he like to sit next to?
He was actually a great guy. He brought his daughter. We had a great conversation, and the best thing was at intermission, the Fox Sports people came up and said, is there anything we can do for you? Great show, all that. I said, yes, you got to give me FaceTime with Paul McCartney. And so there was this little, there were hundreds of people standing behind the barriers outside of his suite, hoping to catch a glimpse. And there was a little waiting area of people who were going in to speak. And the people before were Joe Namath and his daughter and me. And I got to sit there at the bar in his suite and talk to him about why he was playing, why he wanted to do the Super Bowl. And he was on the tarmac at JFK when they parked the planes, and he was sitting there watching the World Trade Center burn. And he said he really wanted to do something. And then he also said that he grew up listening to Boston Pops recordings because his dad had all these Arthur Fiedler recordings.
You are kidding. That is so great.
Wow. So is he charming?
He was very charming. I couldn't get him to come to the 4th of July, which I'm still trying for. Paul, if you're out there and listening. But it could not have been nicer.
You know, Keith Lockhart, every July 4th, when I'm watching you, either I've only been there in person once, but on television, I say, this guy has got to be so nervous he can't even breathe. And you don't appear to be nervous at all. When you're doing that, or even more so, when you're doing the Super Bowl and, what, 1.5 billion people, are you nervous or are you totally in the moment and you know what I mean, obviously.
It's very much like asking Tom Brady if he's nervous before. Well, obviously, he didn't need to be nervous in front of Indy. But
so till it starts,
it's anticipation rather than nerves. If it's nerves, it's of the more positive sort of variety. I'm psyched to do that concert. I realized early on as a conductor, as a young conductor, that it was something that I felt great anticipation for, but not that kind of destructive, nervous sort of quality. And I kind of realized that was why I was doing the right thing.
We're talking to Keith Lockhart, obviously, of the Boston Pops. I can't believe you've held back your most important question this long. It's good you're still holding it back.
Well, I'm going to get to that in 1 second. So I want to ask you about nervousness before the concerts. I mean, I was a teeny, teeny, tiny musician when I was a kid. The thing that's most scary is if you do not have music. Do you ever remember playing anything without any music?
Oh, I do. All of my recitals as a pianist all the way up through 22 or so were done by memory. And that does terrify me.
Oh.
I have conducted without score before. It's been mostly kind of as a show-off sort of thing, or a piece that I've done very, very often and really can do in my sleep. But I don't really think it adds anything to the performance. There's a great story that says that Bruno Walter, famous conductor, was asked about Toscanini. They said, Toscanini always conducts by memory. Why don't you? And he said, well, I can read music.
So let me ask you, Keith Lockhart, famous musician, when you were playing all these piano recitals without music, did you ever forget or start backwards?
I did.
And what'd you do?
I had a memory slip in my senior recital in college, for that matter. Well, you call upon the knowledge you have to dig it out and figure out where you need to be and start there. But it does terrify me. And I always had performance nerve issues as a pianist that I don't have as a conductor.
Is there an etiquette about, because I saw a great pianist actually conducting the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and I can't remember his name, but he was brilliant. But he played the piano and conducted, which is pretty impressive. But he had music. So it's okay. Usually when you see pianists doing a concerto with an orchestra, they don't have music. But I've noticed more and more they do.
Well, in something a situation like that, you're responsible not only for your own part, but you're responsible for the orchestra. And a lot of times, frankly, it makes the orchestra feel better to not think that they're being led by somebody who is happens to be doing the entire thing by memory.
Yeah. Okay.
By the way, most people listening to the show don't know we have a script for the whole 3 hours. You just read something.
Oh, my God.
Now, Keith, you have to put your headphones on because we were talking about, this is a surprise. It turns out
the
21 years you've been doing this, we're actually on the line with us as a good friend of ours who everybody knows, who apparently knows something about the first concert you led with the Boston Pops. I think I got that right. And that, of course, is the great Ron Della Chiesa. Ron, welcome to Boston Public Radio. What's up, Ron?
Boy, it's great to hear you with Keith, my good friend. And I tell you, you haven't touched on Keith's recording career, but he has made some extraordinary albums with this orchestra. I go back to the very first one, Keith, Running Wild, when you made that wonderful tribute to Glenn Miller.
I look so young on that album cover. it's been great. I mean, it's been wonderful to be able to disseminate those things and leave a little bit of a footprint. You know, one of the things about us live performing artists is that we don't make much of a footprint, and those albums are a chance to do that. How are you, man?
I'm fine. And, you know, talking about your first concert, my wife Joyce and I were in the hall that night.
Is this going to be embarrassing?
20 years ago. And you get up on the stage, and you played Wagner, right? You opened with Wagner.
We did. That was second thing, actually. It was Sound the Bells from John Williams first, and then we did Siegfried's Rhine Journey after
that. This is unbelievable. Go ahead, Ron.
Ron's like this.
I turned around, and behind me, there's this lovely couple, we stood up, and we applauded Keith, and I turned around and said, you know, he looks good up there. And I said, well, it's my son. And it's your mom and dad.
Oh,
hey, Ron,
that?
What was the word on the street when this guy got hired, this kid at that time got hired to be in charge of the Boston Pops? What were people saying about him? What were you saying about him?
Well, you know, everybody was wondering about him, but, you know, he had a good track record in Cincinnati with the Pops. He made an album with Mel Torme that I used to play on my afternoon show, in your time slot, by the way, years ago. And I liked what he did with Mel. And then when he came on stage, you know, he got right into it. And I think the feeling was pretty much unanimous opening night.
Well, at least my parents.
That we were in for a great ride.
What kind of reviews did you, by the way, opening night, what were the reviews in the paper the next day? Like, what did they say about you?
Richard Dyer was the lead critic of the Globe at that point, and I believe he was kind and positive. He was always a good friend of the institution and always said good things. And but most importantly, it's about establishing that relationship with the audience, and that takes time. And, you know, it's 100, and at that point it was a 110-year-old organization, and all of a sudden, you know, there's a 35-year-old up there who had actually, until I did my first concerts as a guest with Boston a couple of years before that, I'd never been to a concert in Symphony Hall. The first time I was on the podium. It's a good way to start.
Hey, Ron, we're thrilled you called in. Ron Della Chiesa, one of the great treasures of this building. Ron, thanks so much. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you, Joyce. Ron, for calling in. Well, you had a tough act to follow because by that time, John Williams had already... But John Williams, I mean, he'd done the Jaws thing by then. He must have done most of a lot of his famous movie scores by then. So.
Well, it's been really, of course, there's now 84 years since Fiedler was hired. And there have only been three of us in that period of time. And I think they did a really smart thing. When Fiedler died, they didn't try to replace him with Fiedler. They went to a guy whose fame was already assured for something else, for being the composer who by that point had already written Star Wars and Jaws. And then when John decided to leave, they went a totally different direction, back to somebody who was more of a performer as opposed to a composer, and who was, I'm 25 years younger than my esteemed older colleague, and so they tried to make a very different shift so there weren't direct comparisons.
Keith, did I read somewhere you're filling in, speaking of John Williams, for John Williams somewhere in California?
I am.
What's going on with that?
You know, right before I go to Florida, I thought I'd start by getting out of the cold and going to San Diego. John has a minor medical issue, and of course we wish him well, and it was a big concert of all his music with the San Diego Symphony, and of course him pulling out created some storm in San Diego, because it was a very important concert fundraising-wise and everything for the San Diego Symphony. And they called me last week, and it just so happened I'm going to be on the West Coast visiting family anyway, and it's a great time to turn around and go down to San Diego.
Now, speaking of family, I'm really glad you brought that up, Keith Lockhart. You were kind enough, in the spirit of full disclosure, last time you were here when we asked you about the Olympics. You mentioned that there's somebody you're relatively close to.
I hear you guys are really in favor, by
no,
the way.
Well, actually, no, Marjorie is the problem. I am totally open-minded.
I heard you, Marjorie, with Emily Rooney.
Yes.
Good thing Emily was there.
Yeah, I was trashing them.
Okay.
I'm suspicious.
Well, let's finish a disclosure. You disclosed last time
my wife is the general counsel of Boston 2024.
Okay, so every single elected official or supporter of the Olympics who Boston 2024 comes in the studio, one of the first questions we asked is, have you actually seen the bid? Have you actually seen the bid, Keith Lockhart? Yes or no?
My wife is the general counsel. You think she'd show me any proprietary information?
Wow.
How excited was she when the USOC decided that Boston was the city of the four in the United States? What was it like at home that night?
It's been Boston 2024 was a startup just at the latter part of this last summer. It's a very, very small staff who have worked very, very hard to pull all this information together. And they were pretty thrilled. But the work began immediately. They spent about one day congratulating themselves. And then the USOC people were here going, and this is what you've got to do for the next step. And it is interesting. It's interesting how much conversation has happened about this. I happen to think, even despite, you know, Emily's association, I do think that it could be a great good thing for Boston, but it does need to be played correctly. And that's part of what our, you know, people express skepticism about whether it can be done with no public funds. And all of our elected leaders are saying, yes, it can be done that way. Well, we have to hold them to that.
Keith Lockhart of the Boston Pops, if the Olympics do come here in 2024, obviously the Boston Pops would be part of that celebration someplace. Where would the Pops fit in?
And by the way, this is not why my wife is the general counsel of Boston 2024. I was lucky enough to be, as you know, in Salt Lake City as a music director of the Utah Symphony.
That's right.
And I did get to see during that, I mean, smaller scale, obviously, the Winter Olympics always are. But what incredible and positive transformative things happened in Salt Lake over that time after we got through the scandal and Mitt took over and all of that. And we played the opening ceremonies, an amazing party that really brought the world together. I mean, I'm standing on that stage next to Sting, Yo-Yo Ma, and John Williams. Fireworks are going off. The flag is being carried by Lech Walesa and Desmond Tutu.
Oh, my God.
You know, and the whole time I was thinking, this is one of those things that I will always remember. Incidentally, it was 5 days after the Super Bowl that the Pops played in. So I want to do my own Visa commercial. Keith Lockhart, he's everywhere you want to be.
So, Keith Lockhart, here's a quiz for you before you go. What do you and Marjorie Egan have in common? Let me repeat that. We know it's not your view on the Olympics. What do you and
Catholic
Marjorie Egan...
Catholic spouses.
Well, that may be...
That's right.
Well, that's one thing. But I'm going to give you a hint. There's a culinary aspect to that. You want another hint?
Wow. Okay. We both like sushi.
No, that's actually... No, she hates sushi,
it's
actually.
Something that you make quite well, I understand.
One of your signature dishes and the ingredients. What would
pork
that be?
Tenderloin?
No. Come on.
He's forgotten.
She's Irish. Does that help you out? She's Irish.
Corned beef?
No. Okay, tell them.
Mashed potatoes.
Oh,
I read
that's
about
right.
Your
I actually
spectacular...
bragged. That's because I bragged about them
yes.
in public and on the pages of the Globe. Yes, I do consider myself to be a good mashed potato.
Okay, so let's hear it. We don't want to hear it.
It's the only part of the holiday feast that my wife will let me
prepare. Yeah.
Okay, so what's your secret, Keith Lockhart?
Well, you know, lots of butter goes a long way. But more recently, I've been using a lot of truffle oil because I love truffle mashed potatoes.
And, you know, I've got to try
it's
that.
It's better for you, too, than using a lot of butter.
It is? How about the heavy cream? You go with the heavy cream?
I go straight for butter and milk because I figure the two together make heavy cream.
Okay.
Well, I like that.
I do get the heavy cream myself. I mean, I think I'm going to kill myself with my mashed potatoes.
We'll have a mashed potato
off.
Contest.
And all seriousness, yes. You don't know this. We had a deviled egg off a couple of weeks ago here
with
Jared Bowen,
yeah.
Callie Crossley, and Marjorie Egan. We will hold to this. We're going to do we need a third contestant.
Well,
and we will have a mashed potato off. Marjorie Egan.
What are you bringing to the buffet?
I'm the judge. Thank you very much.
I was
isn't that obvious?
Like a bug. No one liked my
doesn't
deviled
matter.
Eggs whatsoever.
So
everybody
you'll do
else
this,
is
yes?
gone.
I will.
Okay, Keith, before you go, I know you hate this because it's only February. I don't know what it is. Is this January? It's January.
It's January.
How's July 4th looking?
July 4th is a wonderful day. It's in the early part of July. And more details as they become evident. Hey, we haven't even announced everything for the spring season yet, and that's all two months in front
of us. Well, beyond Florida, is there something else you want to tell us about what you're doing now? Or in the immediate future that people should be waiting
for? Some really interesting plans for the spring season, including there's a wonderful show by Stephen Sondheim on Stephen Sondheim called Sondheim on Sondheim that uses all the video footage of him interviewed interspersed with his songs. And we are working with James Lapine, the director of the director of Into the Woods most recently.
I was just going to ask you about Into the Woods.
To bring this to orchestral context and do the premiere performances of it in Boston this June.
Did you see the movie yet?
I did, actually.
What do you think? You're big, for those that don't know, he's a huge Sondheim
fan.
I'm
a huge Sondheim fan, and another full disclosure thing, Robbie Marshall and I were college kids together. Mm. It's great to see. The last show I did in the pit, conducting a musical, he was the choreographer of before he took off to New York and huge things,
great.
And I took off to a concert career. But I thought they solved as many of the problems of doing that very hard to transfer show as possible.
It is hard. I should know this, but I don't. Is the music nominated in the Academy Awards for anything?
I don't think so.
Wow.
I should know that too. I have to say, I thought it was done. It sounded beautiful. It was really wonderful to see that Emily Blunt can sing so well.
Yes.
I also like this guy who's taking over the late show, who's played the baker.
Actually, we just talked about him.
Wilmore?
No. I'll think about it in a second.
Yeah. I didn't know him at all, but I thought he did a wonderful job. Meryl Streep was hysterical in that role. And anyway, we were entranced. And I think that show is all flaws contained. It's a great, great piece of
Do you think, are you convinced, I want to be sure before you leave here, you convinced you can do the Florida thing, you can prepare for these concerts you talked about in a few months and prepare for the mashed potato off simultaneously?
Yeah. Well, I have to watch the Super Bowl, too.
Watch the Super Bowl.
How much truffle oil, please, in the mashed potatoes?
Oh, as much as they can take without getting glutinous and greasy.
All right. We'll give it a shot.
Keith Lockhart, it's great to see you.
Thank you very much for coming in. Keith Lockhart is the Boston Pops conductor. He joins us when his schedule permits. To learn more about Boston Pops and upcoming events, go to bso.org. Keith, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, Marjorie.
Coming up, another homegrown scandal. The last one was Grubergate. Now it's Deflategate. Is there any legitimacy to this, or are we just hardwired to want to take the Patriots down a few notches? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Deflategate is the latest scandal to plague football, at least the Patriots. The NFL is looking into whether the New England Patriots deflated air from the footballs that they used in Sunday's crushing of the Indianapolis Colts. Scandal itself isn't really what interests us, even though if you want to talk about it, it's fine. What does is our insatiable appetite when it comes to hating the Patriots. I shouldn't say our. I mean the public's across this country. We can't let them be a great team. We can't let Brady and Belichick be one of football's terrific historic duos. Everybody's got to cry foul when they win a game, even though it's 45-7. What is it about us where we can't accept perfection? Why is it our compulsion to ruin a good thing or a great thing? 877-301-8970. If you see this in yourself, why do you do it? If you don't, what is the key to being a supremely evolved human being? 877-301-8970. It is totally clear to me that you don't have to be a football fan to be angry at the Patriots. I'm serious. If you're somewhere else in the country, they succeed year after year after year. Brady, as you were saying yesterday, Shira Springer is near perfection. Bill Belichick, even though he's got a personality problem, is one of the most successful coaches ever. But it seems to me that many of us, and you and me included, by the way, from time to time, take out our anger on those people who do things supremely well because of our, I don't know if it's our insecurity or it's something.
Envy.
Envy, whatever it is. And so we want to know if there's something in your life that sort of stacks up with how reviled the Patriots are, which is really what led to this absurd debate about deflating the footballs.
Well, Kevin Collins got a story about this. Everybody outside New England really hating the Patriots all the time, and they point out that Mr. Belichick, with his personality problems, of course, they don't like Tom Brady either. Although I don't understand how you could not like Tom Brady, but they point out that people don't like him because he's the only multimillionaire athlete whose wife is the real breadwinner. I mean, he's got
supermodel
of the year as his wife, and they're just really perfect. But I think this is like the Facebook thing.
What do you mean?
Well, it's one of the reasons people don't like Facebook. People who don't like Facebook is because, you know, you're not going to post pictures of your husband screaming at you or the kids, you know, with the dirty little messy scenes that everybody has in domestic life. You're going to post pictures of your vacation, you know, in the Caribbean over Christmas vacation or graduation. Everybody looks spectacular. You're going to post these pictures of everybody or your new kitchen being remodeled or things that people look at and they think, God, you know, my kitchen is just a dump. And look at Susie's kitchen. You know, Susie, I should have married Susie's husband. And why didn't I, you know, that kind of thing. You're just comparing yourself all the time. It's keep up with the Joneses kind of thing. And I think in some ways the Patriots are so perfect. They're perfect to us too, but, well, they're not perfect. They haven't won a Super Bowl in how many years?
10 years.
So they haven't won a Super Bowl.
They have been consistently wildly successful for 13, 14, 15 years.
You just look at I've said this a million times. You look at Tom Brady and you look at Gisele Bündchen and you think, you know, it's just not fair. I mean, they have everything.
Exactly.
They're smart,
this is what we're talking
they're
about.
They're gorgeous. They seem to be lovely people. They've got good parents. Now, she was a little bit much when she told everybody how she, you know, gave birth in the bathtub and after she had the baby, she'd up and cook pancakes for everybody in the house and how she had no labor pains. I mean, okay, enough already.
Because you're jealous, just like you said.
Of course.
877-301-897. If you think this thing is not going national, ESPN's Pardon the Interruption host, Michael Wilbon, who is a journalist in addition to being a TV host, I find him to be a pretty fair guy. He goes off on the Patriots. Listen to this about Deflategate.
I would say to the New England Patriots, you know what we're going to do if this was found to be true, like today, tomorrow, next 72 hours, next 3 years, you know what? You're forfeiting your spot in the Super Bowl. We're vacating it. Get out. You're a cheater. You're a lying franchise. If true, if you can prove it, get out.
Here's my assessment. I don't know Michael Wilbon from a hole in the wall. I've just watched him on television. He probably got a flat tire yesterday on a car he wishes he could replace. And because the Patriots are borderline perfect and his life, that is really what this, I think, what this is all about. 877-301-8970. The quote that Marjorie and I both like, which is the reflection of this envy thing, is Gore Vidal, the great, great, great writer who died, obviously, but that has nothing to do with anything. He's asked once by, I think, a reporter in an interview, what do you do when one of your close friends has a book that totally tanks, that is a complete disaster? Yeah. What does he say?
My heart leaps with joy.
Exactly. I mean, it speaks so beautifully to the envy, to the jealousy. So we want to know if you suffer through similar kind of angst about other people's successes. And if you're dying to talk about the actual incident or incidents relating to the Patriots, that's fine. But that's not really our focus. Let's start in Boston with Jackie. Jackie, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Jackie.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thanks.
Great. Here's the problem with the Patriots.
Yeah.
They don't win if they don't cheat. We have the video gate. I don't know why Belichick wasn't suspended then. If, and a big if, as Will Warren said, if Deflategate is proven to be true, he needs to be suspended. And he needs to be suspended like the coach of the Saints was suspended for
a whole year, wasn't he? Yeah.
Okay, Jackie,
yeah,
I can tell.
Not his first time, not his last.
Okay, Jackie, you're seething over there about Bill Belichick. What is that about, please?
I'm not seething at all. But I'm a big sports fan, and I'm from New York, and I appreciate the sports history here. You know, I had a big crush on Jim Rice growing up in New York in the 70s, and I was a Yankees fan, so that was a little tough. But I think that if we're talking about holding athletes accountable for every single action that they take off the court as well as on the court, we need to hold the coaches and management to the same standard.
Jackie, okay. Fair enough. You sound like somebody who actually has your anger, if that's the right word, for the right reasons. I would argue you are the outlier, Jackie, and thank you very much for the call. She thinks there's a history of problems need attention.
We don't really want to talk about...
No, but you can.
We want to talk about that part of the reason people don't like the Patriots, especially people that are outside of here, and mm-hmm. Jackie admitted that she was not
Yorker,
from here, she was from New York, that it has to do with the fact that it just seems too perfect. The whole thing seems too perfect. We hear endlessly about the Belichick-Brady marriage. Shira Springer called it yesterday, this perfect meshing of the coach and his quarterback, and isn't it swell? And every time you see Tom Brady with the teeth, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
You know what's a perfect example? I know this is where Marjorie says, well, I'm not really a sports expert. You don't have to be a sports expert. Let's assume the coach of, what was the other team? The Colts. The
Colts.
Team they just crushed,
right.
45-7. Let's assume that the Patriots suggested that the Colts had deflated the footballs and the Colts had even won the game 45-7 instead of, do you think anybody in America, do you think Michael Wilbon, do you think people on the networks, do you think the front page, what did John King tell us? The front pages of all the tabloids in New York and Long Island,
full
in New
hate.
York,
full of hate.
Have front page stories on deflate. You think they'd be doing that if it was the Indianapolis Colts?
Well,
no.
Especially when they did get shellacked. I mean, they'd have to deflate a lot of balls.
No, but I'm saying even if they won, even if they had won the game, it is a Patriots, Belichick, Brady kind of thing.
Remember when Giselle was wanting to pass laws that we all had to breastfeed until the babies were like 6 months
old? She wanted laws to that?
I think she wanted laws. Yeah, she quickly backed down on that. She can get a little bit over the top because she's, you know, telling you, you know, when you're as good looking and gorgeous and wealthy as she is. Well, no, I think you have to kind of realize that, you know, like Gwyneth Paltrow, I mean, your life is not like everybody else's, and what you can do in your rarefied position is not what the rest of us can do. On the other hand, you see her out with the kids all the time. They're out at the playground. I mean, they're
Didn't
like,
she tell us to turn all the, wasn't there a night when she and Tom told us to turn all our lights off?
They were,
what was that? What was that kind of thing?
She put him up to it. They were standing in the kitchen.
Kitchen, right.
And they were giving us advice on how
video,
we needed
right.
to get the more energy efficient
light
bulbs. I
thought it was International Turn Off the Lights Day or some such thing.
I don't know what it was. Anyway.
But by the way, let me tell you about that.
Yeah.
I was seething. 877-301-8970. We're trying to get to what is the motivation for the anger. Take away the Jackies of the world who just called a minute ago, who seems to be upset on the merits. Why is it that virtually all of America, and look at the papers, you'll see it is all of America, is up in arms over the fact that the Patriots might have deflated a drop the footballs on Sunday's game?
Okay. Meg from Boston. What do you think, Meg?
Hi, Meg.
Hey, how are you?
We're great.
I love you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I have something to say about Tom Brady is why I think some people may not be so fond of him. Yesterday you guys were talking about like musicians and artists.
Yeah.
And how sometimes we get so upset when we love their art or their music.
Mm-hmm.
But we have like such an internal struggle when we don't like the things about them in their like personal lives or
right.
their personality.
We're talking about Woody Allen yesterday in particular.
Exactly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. And so I think the whole Tom Brady thing and, you know, his personal life in the past few years and some things that he's chosen to do, I think some people have an issue with that. And it's like all too perfect world he's created. We kind of want to hate him a little bit.
What do you mean? Because he had the kid out of wedlock? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And getting rid of his child's mother. I forget her name.
Bridget Moynihan.
Yeah, exactly. And going with the supermodel. I think some people might have some issues.
Well, I was rooting for Bridget for a long time, but I gave up that fight when I realized that Bridget and Giselle have become budsy wuzzy. I mean, they're hanging out together at the playground. Remember that picture of them in the paper, Meg, when everybody was all lovey-dovey? Plus, Bridget's had a very successful career, and that's why I think Tom and Giselle had to give up their $20 million house in Los Angeles because Bridget moved back to New York. Remember that? That was the other thing that was, as long as I'm going to criticize Tom and Giselle, remember they're giving us all lectures about turning off the lights?
Yeah, we were just talking about
it. While they're building that massive, massive house out there with the wine cellar and
mm-hmm.
everything else. But I think they said they had the low energy bulbs.
I think they did.
In the wine cellar.
They did, and most of the rooms were dark most of the time. I know I've researched it at some length. You know what I like about the story, and the reason we're talking about this, is because I love it when something that is of virtually no significance mm-hmm. grabs the nation in a way that is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And yet, it's everywhere. It is, you know, I want to repeat, as John King said, the front page of the New York City tabloids.
People hate them. It
is staggering.
You know what this is also like?
What's
it's
that?
Also like reading, this is another exercise in torture, reading the alumni pages of your college, you know, magazine, if you get it.
Oh, I know. And they send a little blurb in about
yes. Now, no one is going to send in a blurb that, you know, that their husband lost their job and, you know, they had to sell their home and they're living on, you know, and whatever. No one sends a down on your luck notice to the alumni magazine. So everyone, whether it's, you know, class of 2004, the class of 1994, 84, whatever it is, everybody sends in all their stellar achievements. I hate reading that, too. You know what I mean? I mean, they're the president of such and such a company, and they were all billionaires or something. I mean, it's just It just is. I don't
want to hear
why,
one of the most humiliating experiences.
I guess that's the question: is why do I do it?
You want to hear one of the most humiliating experiences of my whole life? The Alumni Magazine, where I went to college, University of Pennsylvania, is a Penn Gazette.
Yeah, Penn Gazette.
The first thing I go to every month when I get it is exactly that.
Yeah, your class.
First we go to
compare.
You go to alumni notes. And I always mocked these things because they all do the same thing you talked about. You want to talk about the most humiliating experience? I broke down. I've never admitted this to you. Mm-hmm. I broke down about 7 or 8 years ago and sent in something about my TV and radio work here. They didn't publish it. How pathetic is that? So-and-so is a pediatrician who got the Pediatrician of the Year Award in Jamoke, California.
Why would they not publish
it? I have no idea. I was so mortified I didn't even ask them. 877-301-8970 is envy. What is it at work that causes us to be so many of us, not all of us, to be so jealous of others who have had wild success like the Patriots, which we think is at the root of this Deflategate thing? Let's go back to the calls.
Alma from Somerville. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Alma.
Hi.
Hi.
Number one, I think a lot of it is what has been said about how perfect Tom Brady seems to be and his wife and the Patriots been so much. And Bill Belichick is not exactly, as Calvin Collins said, this Mr. Personality. So it's easy to dislike him.
Yeah.
And then they had Eric Mangini, who regretted afterwards that he, you know, cheated.
Former assistant, yeah.
But the thing about two things. One, Spygate, there's a lot of evidence that, in fact, Belichick didn't really cheat, that he actually followed the rules, but nobody actually looked at the specifics of the case. It was like,
you know,
they were out to get him.
Alma, what was that? What was that? That they were looking at tapes?
You know, as far as he was supposed to be filming their play
when
he did it.
Their practice, yeah.
Somebody was like walking by and had a camera, but I don't know if they actually saw him filming it. And they threw away the tape, so they didn't have the evidence, which, of course, is yet another questionable thing Goodell did. But the main thing that I want to say is, if anybody out there who watches or listens does football at all thinks that every team doesn't cheat to one degree or another, they are very naive. Bill Parcells told a story. I don't watch much of this, but I happened to watch one of the pregame shows.
Yeah.
He told a story about Bill Walsh, St. Bill Walsh of the San Francisco 49ers.
What about him?
And before, a lot of teams used to give their quarterback the first 15 plays. He gave his quarterback the first 15 plays and then fixed it so the headsets on the field wouldn't work, so the guys in the booth couldn't tell him the play.
Love
he fixed that.
You mean the other team?
His team had all the plays. The other team didn't. He had a big advantage. That's the kind of thing they all do. And then, you know, it's just because people like to hate because they see a beautiful life. They think it's better than theirs. And so they want to hate. But so much of it is just pure mythology.
Alma, brilliant call.
Thank you
for your analysis of the history of these issues.
Well, Shannon just emailed and said that history shows that behind perfection, there are often heinous acts.
Oof.
Therefore, the Patriots must have deflated the balls. And who knows what's really going on in the Tom Giselle household. I'm only kidding about that last part. I'm sure they're wonderful parents.
We're going to do 3 hours tomorrow on the science of the deflated football for those of you who really want to go deep on this particular issue.
Coming up, as the Tsarnaev jury is being selected up at the federal courthouse, we're going to talk to veteran journalist Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge about their new book on the Marathon bombing. Stay tuned for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brody. She's Marjorie Egan. For anybody who was in Boston when the bombs exploded at the marathon finish line, it is hard to imagine you'd ever forget anything that happened that day. But after 2 years, all of us have, at least some. There are also probably details from those events you couldn't appreciate at the time. But today, when you revisit them, they take on new meaning. All of this becomes clear when you read the terrific new book by Dave Wedge and Casey Sherman. It's called Boston Strong: A City's Triumph Over Tragedy. The book has also been picked up by 20th Century Fox. Dave, Casey, great to see you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks. You both for coming in. So before we get to what you've done in the book, you've really looked into the Tsarnaev family, the mom who has some difficulties, the sons, obviously the murders and stuff. The jury's being selected, as I just said, up at the federal courthouse for the trial. Do you have any insights or clues or what the heck was going on with this younger brother, Johar? I think that's the big unanswered question for a lot of us.
Well, people keep asking, you know, was he influenced by his brother? There's no doubt that he was influenced by his brother, who was influenced by their mother. You know, the mother is really the Lady Macbeth, if you will, in this entire tragedy, in my opinion. Once she lost control over her sons, you know, she threw the Quran at them and, you know, set them off on this jihadi crusade, or this journey, if you will. And I think Tamerlan was the first one who really lost himself in that. And then he brought his brother along as well. But you know what? We're all influenced by people every day about our actions. And I have no sympathy for what they did.
Yeah, sympathy or not, I assume virtually nobody listening here today has sympathy, Casey. But it seems, and this is all conjecture, that the only real defense that this Judy Clark, who is the expert on getting people committed of capital crimes to not get the death penalty, is that this guy's got a record of, Johar, a clean record. People say he's a nice kid. There'll be character witnesses. The only thing it seems to me they can come up with is the influence was so strong that it rose to a level where he didn't even have control over himself anymore. Based on the research you guys did and the people you talked to, is that I know you have no sympathy, but is that a credible case to be made that he was so under the thumb of this boxing older brother?
Well, I think that's the, like you said, Jim, that's the only avenue they have to go down.
But is there any there, Dave Wedge?
I mean, like Casey said, I mean, clearly he was influenced by his brother. Is that a defense for what he did? I would say no. You know, I look at it a lot like the, there is precedent for that sort of defense in Massachusetts in this sort of case. Remember the Attleboro cult case, which I covered very closely. And that
was the devil worshippers, people?
No, this was the woman, they starved their baby to death.
Oh, God, yeah. Yes.
And the mom
God.
Actually got convicted of a lesser charge because she argued battered women's syndrome because she said her husband forced her to starve her baby to death. The husband got first degree. She got second degree. So there is precedent there for that sort of defense.
But I want to be
federal terrorism case, I think it's a stretch.
But before deciding how the judge or jury would rule on this thing, give us a couple of examples, if you could, either of you guys. What are the quote, factual things that the Tsarnaev lawyers would argue that would be evidence in their mind of him, the younger Tsarnaev, being under the influence of the older Dave?
Well, I think one thing is what was excluded from the trial, and that's the evidence about the Waltham murders. Mm-hmm. I think the avenue they want to go down there is that the younger brother knew that his older brother took part in those murders. And
with Abraham Todashev, allegedly,
yeah,
right?
In Waltham, when the three guys' throats were slit and they were covered in marijuana, and there's an implication that Tamerlan was involved in those. The implication there from the defense attorney would be he was scared of his brother because
he's a murderer. You know, Casey, I am obsessed with the Waltham triple murder, and I've read that part of your book, but. And the facts are, for those who don't recall, the triple murder happened about a year and a half before the marathon. And if the FBI is right,
on 9/11,
on the anniversary of 9/11.
If Todashev, who was allegedly about to sign a confession when he was killed by the FBI agent in Orlando, and Tamerlan Tsarnaev did it, and the authorities had pursued that and gotten the older Tsarnaev, by definition, there wouldn't have been a marathon bombing. Where do you the sense I get from afar? Is there was not a lot of enthusiasm for solving this thing. It was a bunch of drug dealers was the wisdom of the day. Why was there not more energy put into solving that triple murder?
Well, to your point, Jim, they categorized it as a bunch of drug dealers, that this was a drug deal gone heinously wrong. But, you know, the victims in that case, I mean, they were really characters out of a Seth Rogen movie. These weren't hard, gangbanger types of people, and they were just brutally murdered in this apartment house. And the fact that the authorities at the time didn't piece together, the clues that they should have looked at the anniversary. I mean, this wasn't just any day on the calendar. Then you have, Brendan Mess, who was one of the victims, his closest Muslim friend, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, doesn't show up at the funeral and then vanishes.
And is never questioned by law enforcement authorities. It's unbelievable. So what? But Casey, if I may, I don't want to obsess on this anymore, but just one last question. So what is the explanation as to why they didn't pursue it? That they mistakenly just thought it was drug dealers and we don't really care about drug dealers? Is that what the rationale is?
To me, I think that's okay. What it is.
Well, I also think that information came out after the bombing. Once Tamerlan was named a suspect in the bombing, I think people came forward after that.
I think that's what the sequence was.
And this is really not off subject because you talk about this in your book. By the way, the name of the book is Boston Strong, A City's Triumph Over Tragedy. And the voices you're hearing are the co-authors, Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge. Before we get back to the day of the marathon itself, what I've always wondered is, what was the motive? If Tamerlan and this Tartishev guy went in and killed these three people, it wasn't drugs. They sprinkled the drugs all over them. Why did they kill him?
To me, it was a warning. To your point, they didn't take any drugs. They really didn't take any money either. This is where conjecture, you know, we're hoping that more information comes out of the trial. What we believe is that this was a warning that could have even been a warning to Jokar, for someone who was going down the wrong path, if you will, with, you know, marijuana, smoking, et cetera. I think, you know, Tamerlan didn't like the fact that these guys were dealing with drugs and wanted to send a message. But he also wanted to know what it felt like to kill somebody. I think this was training for him personally.
So like almost like a practice run?
He needed to be baptized in blood, and that's what he was. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're talking to Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge, whose new book is Boston Strong, A City's Triumph Over Tragedy. So you guys start the book, excellent job, by the way, at the morning up in Lexington. Tell people how you began this.
Well, you know, when we started to look at this story, we just went back to the history of this city and the fact that Boston is a very tribal city. You know, we have the neighborhoods that always have our ethnic tension, clashes, etc. But anytime you get a foreign invader, whether it be the British in 1776 or two Chechen brothers in 2013, you know, the city unites. And I couldn't get that vision out of my head of those reenactors falling on cue and the smoke and, you know, this baptism in blood on Lexington Green, something that everybody applauds for at the end, never realizing that a few hours later they would be seeing the real thing on a massive scale.
And you talked, Dave Wedge, about a police officer that we've heard the name of for many years, Dan Keeler, that was getting up that morning to tell us, what was he doing?
Well, Danny Keeler, his job every year is to coordinate the security for the marathon. So he was, like, in charge at the scene when the bombs first went off. He was the first commanding officer to jump on the air and say, we've got explosions. They cleared the air. We talk about in the book, they cleared the air. They said, we only want to hear from Sergeant Keeler. And he took command at the scene in the immediate aftermath of the bombs. He was the one that gave the order, said, let's lock down all the video. And that video became crucial to the investigation and ultimately led to the capture of the two brothers.
And you have, Dave, a very poignant anecdote about Keeler in the ambulance with Crystal Campbell, who was one of the young women that was killed. Tell us about that. This is Casey.
Yeah. No, I mean, Danny saw, you know, she had a look on her face as like she was smiling. You know, we wrote, in death she was smiling. And it was something that Danny just could not get out of his head. Anybody that reads the book, Dave and I wrote this book, I mean, those are the images and those are the memories that are embedded in our hearts when we're writing it. And those are the things that I hope anybody that reads this book will never forget. You know, go ahead.
Casey, you know, the most important part of the book to me is that you spent all this time with the real people whose lives were affected. And I said this to Dave in a recent interview, and I'm sure I said it to you too, Casey, or if not, I've said it on the air. We only get to see the smiles, the strength, I'm up dancing again kind of thing. You got to be with these people when the lights were not on, when they weren't being interviewed and talked about the strength. I mean, pick a person or two, Dave Wedge. What has life been like for, you know, almost 2 years now for a lot of the people who have become almost, you know, legendary figures in this community?
Well, one of the things that the questions we get most commonly is what are these survivors and people that were impacted by what happened, what do they think about the trial and what do they want?
Yeah.
And the thing that Casey and I found out in spending so much time with the survivors and the victims' families is that there's a range of emotions and a range of grief, obviously. Some of them want to know everything. Some of them want – and that's why when we originally set out to do the book, we weren't going to tell a big involved story about the two brothers. But as we got into it and met with these people more and more, we found that they wanted more information. They want to know – some of them want to know everything. Some of them are going to attend every
Mark
day Fukeril of that
trial. Mark is going every single day,
Mark
isn't
Fukeril,
he?
Mark Michelle LaRue, who's in our book, nearly lost her leg. Her arm was damaged. She lost some hearing. She's a very inspirational character in our book. She's, you know, never thought she'd be able to do the things that she loved to do again, and now she's back horseback riding and skiing when she never thought she'd be able to do that stuff. She's also a very she's a fire plug, and she is one of the folks that I would point to that she wants to know everything. She can't get enough information about it, and she'll be at the trial a lot as well.
Yeah, exactly, and she's an incredible inspiration. I think people are going to find inspirational characters in this book. Michelle actually flew to Paris last week to show solidarity with the victims of terror there.
Oh, wow.
Laying down flowers in a sign that said Boston Strong, feels for you, if you will. She's also running for training for her first marathon. She was never a runner before. Now she's doing it. So a lot of these survivors are using the Sarnia brothers as motivation to do things that they never did before.
We're talking with Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge. Their new book is Boston Strong, A City's Triumph Over Tragedy. You know, tell people that don't know about this, about the boat trip of a lot of the survivors that you
guys...
I was
in France too, right? Wasn't that in France?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, so it was a trip. Dave. It was a trip organized by a company called Vantage Travel out of Boston. They run cruises down the rivers of Europe. And Carlos Arredondo actually went on an earlier cruise a few years previous. He does a lot of work with the Wounded Warriors Project.
Yep.
So when the bombings happened and Carlos became kind of the face of the bombings, the ower of the company, what's his name?
Hank Lewis, Vantage.
By the way, Carlos is the man with the cowboy hat
right.
three people who don't
Jeff
know,
Bauman,
of course. Yeah.
And so Hank Lewis saw Carlos on TV and said, hey, that's the guy. He's been on some of our trips. And as they thought about how they could help the city heal, Hank and his wife Trish, that owned Vantage, said, let's organize a trip for the survivors and the first responders, and they did that, and they donated the entire trip, and 100 of the survivors and their families went on this trip, and as we call it in the book, it was really floating therapy. They all literally healed together away from Boston, away from the spotlight, and Casey and I were fortunate enough to have a fun seat.
What kind of relationship do they – I mean, I understand you can't – it's not a monolith.
Sure.
It's just as Dave said before, some are obsessed with the Sarnia thing. Some don't want to know that much about it. Are there deep relationships between a lot of these people? That like, we know that the relationship between Bowman, the young guy lost both his legs, and Carlos Arredondo, who saved him, is deep. What about other people?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I think, that tragedy has brought forth lifelong friendships. Michelle LaRue talks about that quite a bit. Well, you know, had that not happened, she wouldn't have met Sabrina Della Russo, who was at the second bombing location. And those two became friends on that cruise in France. And now they're best friends today. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very prescient, that cruise in France a year ago, because as we were traveling in France, you had some of the survivors that were very worried because it was a high-profile cruise. And they were worried that now we have 100 Boston Marathon survivors all grouped together. Is there a terrorist out there who's going
wow.
to finish the
wow.
job? And now a year later, we don't realize how serious a threat that could have been.
And there were some that actually – there was one that we know of that actually was at the airport and decided against going. So there was a lot
for
of
that,
fear.
Because of that
trip,
fear.
It was very – it was intense. It was that and the combination of the intensity of all these people being together suddenly. They're trying to heal on their own, and suddenly they're in this group situation where everyone's, again, grieving at different levels. And what we saw on the trip, and we describe in a chapter in the book, is that the first day of the trip was – I mean, it was – the emotion was off the charts. People didn't know what to say. It was almost awkward where you didn't want to talk about the bombing, but you couldn't not talk about the bombing because everyone's around you.
For that, yeah.
But as the days went on and people had meals together and went on trips to ancient churches together and shared, you know, amazing bottles of wine together, everybody bonded and they really became friendly. And we have some great moments in there with Carlos Arredondo again bonding with Ling Zilu's dad, who came from China. It was his first time back to meet with any of these people since the bombing actually happened. And they bonded as grieving dads, because Carlos had already lost his two sons.
By the way, I'm so glad you said that. You know, most people got to know Carlos Arredondo in the wake of that historic photograph. Carlos lost one son in Iraq, mm-hmm. And he and his wife have been working for peace forever in the most relentless way. He lost his other son and took his own life. I mean, just lived through horrible tragedy, personal tragedy himself, and then comes to the rescue as one of the heroes of this incredible day.
And that's how him and Ling Zilu's dad bonded on the trip.
Common suffering.
Common suffering, exactly, as opposed to, you know, bombing – victims.
And there was one incredible moment on the cruise where you had a first responder who was describing why he was on the cruise. He had saved a young girl's life in front of Marathon Sports. And he's going through this this tale of woe, talking about how he pulled her from the rubble, couldn't see what she looked like, never got her name, had no idea where she was or how she was doing a year later. And the person across the table listening to the story was the little girl he saved.
Oh, my God. Oh, that is unbelievable. We're talking to Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge about their book, Boston Strong. What's the subtitle
list? A City's Triumph Over Tragedy.
My apologies. Go ahead.
You know what I wonder? I mean, Dave and I have been reporters. We were at the Boston Herald together for a long time, covering a lot of crime and terrible, terrible things. And one of the things I thought about in this case is that, you know, in some ways, as awful as what everybody went through, there is comfort in being with other people who've been through exactly the same thing. I mean, if you just walk across the street and get run over by a truck or something, there's no group you can go to. You know, you can go to the parents who lost kids thing. But that is going to be very, very helpful to be able to compare notes from everything on your prosthetic device to, you know what I mean?
It is, absolutely. And that's one of the things that we found is, you know, when major tragedies like this happen, like 9/11 or the Oklahoma tornadoes or the Marathon bombings, they set up these group therapy sessions, and a lot of people think that's lip service, but what we found from spending a lot of time with these survivors is that they were essential to their recovery. People like Heather Abbott regularly meets with Adrian Haslett Davis and Roseanne Sedoya. They get to get Jessica Downs.
Correct, yeah.
They all lost a leg.
Yeah.
And you know, that's something that no one can understand except for them. And they get together regularly, formally with they went to rehabilitation sessions, but informally they get together and they have coffee. And like Casey said, they're lifelong friends now, and they have this unfortunate common bond, but it's also a blessing that they have it because they always have someone to talk to about what they're going through, and they can turn to people that truly understand.
Casey, before you go, and same for you, Dave, in a second, what's the one thing that the vast majority of readers of this book will not have known before that they're going to be that they're going to take away?
Well, you know, I think one of the people or figures involved in this tragedy that it may have been forgotten over the past couple of years is Sean Collier, the MIT police officer. You know, he's rarely mentioned in copy anymore. We try to paint a very vivid picture of who this young man was before he was literally executed in Cambridge. And, you know, we spent several hours with his family, and they told us stories that they had never heard while he was alive. But once he been killed, you know, organizations would come up to them and say, do you know he raised all this money for us? Or do you know he was starting this organization for us? Here's a young guy. When I was 24 years old, I didn't know what the heck I wanted to do. And he made us certainly feel, you know, very, very shallow, if you will.
How about you, Dave?
I think Sean Collier is really a big part of it. There's a lot of details in there that are new, I think. I think one of them is about the Richard family funeral. The Richard family was – there was this threat of the Westboro Baptist Church that was going to protest, amazingly, protest a child's funeral. And it got so stressful for the family that they actually had to plan a decoy funeral to avoid the possibility of the Westboro Baptist Church having to ruin their son's funeral.
One of some of the most despicable people on the planet Earth, I should say.
It's mind-boggling that the family had to go to those lengths to avoid that sort of negative attention.
In
that moment of amazing
I certainly
grief,
learned things I didn't know about the Richard family, including the scene in there you have when the father's in the hospital. And if people don't know, Martin Richard, 8 years old, he was lost, and then his sister Jane lost her leg, and the mother was injured, and the father and perforated eardrum, he couldn't hear when they came to tell him that his son had died. He had to keep saying what?
It's agonizing, and you know. But again, the resiliency of that family is amazing.
And people don't realize that Martin was alive for a few seconds before he passed, and he asked, "Where's Jane? How's Jane, my sister?"
Okay.
Casey, Dave, thanks so much. Congratulations.
Boston Strong, A City's Triumph Over Tragedy. Dave Wedge and Casey Sherman are the authors. Thank you very much for being here. Coming up, it's time to ask This Old House. Kevin O'Connor and Richard Rathui join us to take our questions and yours. More from you than from us. Next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan here with us in Studio 3 of the men you know by way of Boston's homegrown television show, This Old House. This fall, they turn 35 years old, and they're celebrating their roots with an all-American anniversary season. Joining us for their monthly radio edition of Ask This Old House are Kevin O'Connor. He's the host of This Old House and Ask This Old House. Hi, Kevin.
Good afternoon.
And then there is that heating and plumbing expert, Richard Trethewey. Richard, it is great to see you.
Hi, guys. Nice to be back.
And by the way, in a couple of minutes after we talk to them, Richard, Kevin, and I will answer all your questions about – what's the matter? We'll answer all – let me finish, please. We'll answer all your questions about issues with your home. I don't find that to be that funny, actually. I don't know what the problem is. I'll participate.
You know, we just saw you guys the other night at a WGBH event, and I wanted to ask you that night, but of course I didn't get a chance to because we were busy doing other things. But tonight, you're doing this project in Lexington, which is not an old house. I don't think most people think houses in the 60s are an old house. But you're remodeling a house up there, and there was this great kind of sad story almost from a woman now grown up who lived there her whole life and talked about going back and seeing the renovations that you've done. Did you see this piece? You're looking at me like you don't know what I'm talking about.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Then why do you look so surprised?
Right?
Yes.
I didn't know she was so sad.
Well, she wasn't. Well, there was, you know, she talked about remembering parts of the house that, of course, were different because it was all being renovated. I guess she wasn't sad. She was nostalgic.
Wistful.
She was nostalgic.
Right.
Absolutely.
It was bittersweet. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But so, I mean, what does that tell you? To me, it tells you that your house isn't really your house, right? You just have it for a short period of time. Most
how
of these houses.
Zen of you.
No, I know. Even a young house like 1966 is going to be the home to, by this time, three or four families, right?
Yeah.
And so very few of us build a new house. Many of us buy someone else's house, and then we move out of it and sell it to someone else.
Yeah.
You know what you should have done, Richard? You know what's great? You should have called this episode Not This Old House, because isn't it the newest? Is it not the newest house you guys have ever done?
It is the newest.
66 or something?
Yep, 1966, but it's still a colonial style, which we're trying to celebrate, you know, that very common style, particularly to New England, that colonial style. You know, before I let you go, I lived it firsthand. I remodeled a house that we moved into and put in a new kitchen, and I always was horrified that the original owners could ever have raised five children in this kitchen. And they came back to the house, and they were horrified.
They were horrified.
And the woman said, come on, let's go, Buzzy. They wrecked this house.
I can't believe you said that, Richard. I said to Marjorie this morning, by the way, forgot to tell you, they're here to answer your questions. 877-301-8970. Anything that falls within their ambit and beyond, give them a buzz. 877-301-8970. I can't believe you said what you said, because I said to Marjorie after reading that woman's story about her parents' house or the house she grew up in, whatever, do you ever have that issue with somebody who you select who says, come on, this is great. I can't believe you're going to update and fix my thing. And then all of a sudden they start getting sentimental. Well, I wanted that porch changed, but that's the porch where my father used to rock me on his lap kind of thing. Richard, do you ever have those kind of issues?
We actually have a counseling service for those people.
No, you do not.
We do. It's part of our service to them.
You never have that kind of problem, Kevin?
No, I don't think we have because they've already decided by the time we get involved.
Yeah, intellectually, not emotionally, though,
No, I don't think so. And keep in mind, the people who are asking us to fix up their houses, the houses are pretty beat up. I mean, they're pretty ready for Tom Silva to come in and start tearing things apart. And they've been living with a heating and cooling system that Richard needs to get his hands on. I will admit, I grew up in the same house as a child. I was there from the day I was born to going off to college. It's my parents have since sold it because they downsized when the kids all moved out.
Pleasantville.
But on Thanksgiving weekend, when we all travel back to Mom and Dad's house, there's a little reservation nearby the old home. We go for a hike as a family. We always drive by the old house to look at it. And we're probably the creep. Like, there's four cars now because they're all with our kids and everything. And we drive real slow past 34 Mountain Avenue. And we've never met the people who bought it.
Right.
And they must be like, why does this happen every day after Thanksgiving?
Yeah. So do you want to go back in and look at it?
I do. But I kind of don't.
Yeah.
Because I can remember exactly where everything was. And I can remember the color of the carpet. And I'm just like, I know it's not there. Because we were poor folk growing up, and we had like bad shag and six kids in a room and all that. And I know it's nicer now, but you do kind of want to.
Well, you know what's really upsetting is if your house was, you know, if your mom and dad painted the house and kept it up, and then it sold, and then you go buy it, and it's all falling apart. Mm. That's so depressing. You just want to shoot yourself.
Yeah. I will say that we did a project when we were kids in that house where we stripped wallpaper off of a wall in a given room. And underneath the wallpaper, the previous people or someone previous had written stuff on the wall. which was the coolest thing. And we were just like, oh, look what we found. And then mom and dad said, in a moment of something my dad would never do, he said, you guys can write on the wall too. And I'd be horrified for what the people found.
You know, when you, Kevin, said a couple of minutes ago, I grew up in a poor folk, poor family. Remember the great scene in The Jerk where Steve Martin says, I grew up a poor black boy in Mississippi.
That's right.
Okay, forget that. 877.
The new phone book's here.
Okay. It wasn't anything like that. I'm just saying, too many kids in a too small house.
301-8897. Before we get to the calls, and the lines fill up in 10 seconds every time you guys are here, when those people came and were either, I don't know if appalled is the right word, but flipped out because it was different, Richard Trithewey, did they literally say, I got to go?
She said it. She looked at her husband and she said, Buzzy, we got to go. They've wrecked the place.
And I said,
really? We're just trying to figure it out. And I still don't know how they raised kids. The kitchen was this little broom closet of a thing. And so you can't always please everybody.
Buzzy. Maybe that was a sign. Maybe it being a miss. I don't know. So look at the calls. You get them on the screen. You can pick your own there.
Oh, yeah. Kevin's the host for this segment. Yeah. I forgot. Yeah, go ahead, Kevin. Pick one.
You have to remind me of which of the better
pick anything
ones
you want.
With.
No, they're okay, no better. There, yeah. Just pick one.
Alan from Canton. How about Alan from Canton?
Hi, Alan.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question for Richard. My water heater, gas-fired water heater in the basement, is at least 10 years old and maybe as many as 15. We've been in the house for 20, and I know I replaced it at about the five-year mark. And I've never done any maintenance on it. It's at the point now where after I run hot water, it makes these loud knocking noises. Is there anything I can do? Is it dangerous?
Well, I got to ask you, in all this excitement, how lucky do you feel?
Oh, my.
Very good.
That is pathetic.
A water heater has – there's never been anything designed with more planned obsolescence than a tank-type water heater. It is a glass-lined steel tank designed to fail exactly at 9 years and 7 months. So, you know, you could – when you first got installed, you could flush it every couple of weeks to keep the sediment out of the bottom. If you're hearing that kettling sound, it means that the hardness in the water has settled to the bottom of the tank. Now, that affects – the fire-to-water transfer. There's a flame underneath, so imagine it would be a pot that was insulated. So it's going to work harder, and ultimately it'll burn through, and you will see water on your floor. If it's a nice finished basement, you should proact and change it, even though it's painful and you don't want to do it. If you have a finished basement, you should think about it.
Okay.
Alan, thanks for the call.
Richard, I want to ask you, why is that done? I mean, that's just so you have to keep buying water heaters. Mm-hmm. Why don't they make a better water heater that you can keep for 25 years?
I honestly don't know. It's a multi-billion dollar industry in this country, and we got to think about filling the landfills. You know, in other parts of the planet, we've got instantaneous water heaters that are all stainless steel and copper that can be recycled. A glass-lined steel tank is just what it is. It's a tough product both for its life expectancy, but also what do you do with them when they're gone? Like, you got to break them down and try to recycle them, but it generally just fills the landfill.
But the key thing, let me get back to what you said, Alan, a minute ago, Richard. If you do that thing where you bend the
the water out of the bottom.
And draw the water out, and it's brown, and then it turns white. If you do that regularly enough, you're going to preserve.
That'll help. It won't guarantee it because it's also a function of water quality. And also, in the inside of these tanks when they're manufactured, they are monitored in crazes per inch, meaning cracks in the enamel and what's acceptable. And so over time, they will leak. There's also a thing called an anode rod, this sacrificial rod that is down inside of any water heater, much like a zinc that's on a boat to keep from corrosion happening. And if somebody was to replace those anode rods in a regular interval every 2 to 5 years, you could get 50 years out of a water heater. No one has ever done it, but it is. So there is this caveat that you could indeed have a water heater last a long time. But
The thing that Richard's not saying, though, is that they do make a superior water heater. It's just that it costs a lot more.
Correct.
And two things happen, right? We don't want to spend the money because you're kind of like, whoa, I can buy it for $1,000, but you're telling me that yours costs $2,000?
Yeah.
So that's the first reason. And the second reason is, when does it break, right? Yeah. You've told this story a million times. It breaks in the middle of the night. Yeah. You pick up the phone in a panic, and the plumber comes over and says, I can replace exactly what you had right now. You can be up and running in 30 minutes because he's got one on the truck.
Yeah.
And so the cycle just kind of continues.
Yes.
You never install what that gentleman is talking about when we do with this old house project. We're always upgraded into a more efficient, longer lasting option.
Yeah. Usually
they are
stainless steel, some sort of stainless steel tank.
Yeah. They are out there.
How much does the stainless steel one cost? $2,000?
It would be more. Yeah.
Okay. There's more than $2,000?
No. But there's no stainless steel burner that has a gas burner under it. It's only a stainless steel tank that would work in conjunction with a heating boiler,
okay,
which many people around New England have.
877-301-8970 is our number. What's the email address, please, Jim?
I have no idea.
BPR at WGBH.org. I believe that is it. If not, we'll be corrected.
Close enough. Okay, Kevin, you're doing great so far. Taking the call. Let's do another one.
Cheryl is trying to get in here about her basement septic.
Wait, Cheryl from Shirley? That's not possible.
It is. Yeah. Cheryl from Shirley.
Is that right?
Are you suggesting that I'm only asking the plumbing
You're not taking any banking questions?
There is one here. There's a banking question coming up. I'll go to that next.
Really?
Cheryl, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make fun of your residence. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Yes. A couple years ago on this old house, you renovated a house and put the septic system into the basement. It was a series of tanks.
Yes.
And I looked it up on the internet because I thought it was really interesting, but it says that we can't use it yet in Massachusetts or at that time.
Absolutely.
Is it okay to use something like that in Massachusetts?
I can't believe she remembers that, by the way.
Oh, sure.
That is so
great. Do we have to make a citizen's arrest?
This is one of the most brilliant inventions I've ever seen in my 35 years on the show.
That was my thought, too.
It's a self-contained sewage treatment plant so that you could, you could literally drink the water. As we showed on camera, you can drink the water that comes out of the end of the sewage. It's actually very good. It makes your Mr.
Tasty.
Coffee last longer, too.
I will just say for the record that in the scene where we had to do it, I passed on drinking, and I gave it to the guy who was selling the thing. I said, nah, you first.
Right. So to answer your question, in Massachusetts, it is technically it's allowed. But as only Massachusetts could do, Marjorie and Jim can explain Massachusetts better than I can.
Sure.
It says you can use it as long as you have a perfectly operating septic system behind it. So it means
meaning why would you bother?
Correct.
Exactly.
So, but I think the real worry is that if you had this, it would mean that almost any parcel in Massachusetts could have a house on it now.
Yes.
And one of the ways that they control development near the waterfront, near the lakefront, is with the septic restrictions. And so this is a way to slow development, in my opinion, because it's a brilliant system. There's so many septic systems that are terrible, failed, and they're still leaching into the ocean and or the lake. This is a device that is monitored. It works, but it's not yet allowed in Massachusetts. It's allowed in Maine, and it's allowed in New Hampshire, and I'm not sure about Rhode Island.
Hey, Cheryl, you still there, Cheryl?
Yes.
The question on everybody's mind, who do you prefer more on the show, Kevin or Richard?
Answer wisely, Cheryl.
Who do you think is better on the show, Cheryl?
Oh, my goodness.
Better for what?
For you. Who gets you happier? Who gets you going? Kevin or Richard? Tell the truth.
Kevin has a wonderful smile. Richard does, too, but he also has a lot of really interesting information.
Ooh.
So Kevin's like a shallow, just smiley face.
That's right.
Cheryl, while we're at it, before you go, whole thing between these other two people in the room here. do you have a favorite between Jim and Marjorie?
No, but see, there's a difference. I am happy that I am not preferred by anybody listening to the show.
She might prefer you, Jim.
I would never put you on the spot.
Nobody
like that,
does,
Cheryl.
And that's fine.
Jim
Cheryl,
had
thank
his picture
you.
In the Globe today.
No, it was a caricature.
It was a caricature
it was
in the Globe today.
Thank
and
you.
I think that many people are swooning in certain quarters.
They should be if they haven't seen it. It happens to be on page C6, not that I remember. Thank you. Cheryl, thanks for the call. Actually, there's one up your alley right here, Kevin.
Come on.
So Tim. Yes.
Get in the game.
Something with finance.
Hi, Tim.
Awesome. How you guys doing?
Great.
Good.
So me and my wife, fairly younger couple, we've been renting for a very long time. We're looking to buy our first home. Now, we've been apartment living for a long time. She's all about a single family, and I'm all about a purchase and rehab loan for a two-family for income property later on. She thinks that this is not such a bright idea, and I was wondering what your take would be on.
That's a great question.
That is a good question. I'll tell you my experience. I think it's a personal decision, to be honest with you, but I'll share with you my story. The first home that I bought with my wife was a two-family. It was a fixer-upper, and our entire goal was to live in it, fix it up, and then eventually use it as an income property. Partially while we were there, have someone live in the other half, and then eventually when we moved out. And it worked out really well. It's still working out well. We are now no longer in the house. Both units are rented all the time, and it's paying for itself in total. So the rent covers everything in terms of mortgage taxes, the whole deal. So for me, it was a spectacular decision that worked out really well. The advantage was that we bought it cheap because it was in really bad condition. We did a lot of work. to fix it up to make it look nice. And it looks a little nicer than every other rental property in the neighborhood. So that when it goes up on the market and they see the pictures, we get a lot of calls saying, oh, I'd love to rent that place.
What color was that house?
He's not fun to be with, this
what
guy.
What color
Richard.
Was that house?
Listen, Tim, the color doesn't really matter.
What you color was it, Kev?
All right, it happened to be pink.
No, it wasn't.
It happened to be a pink house.
Pink. It was pink.
Really?
That's huge. Yeah.
And we kept it pink for years.
Okay, Tim, I have the other side of the story. I live in a two-family, but it's not two-family. It's two condos. I have the upstairs people that run up downstairs. And the guy that lived there before, the purchase now, he was very clever, like you. He rehabbed the whole house. But instead of taking him like 4 months, like he told his wife, it took him about a year and a half. And they were, you know, it was the saws and the drills, everything else was going like not. She was ready to kill him by the end of this rehab. I mean, even if you're good at these, I mean, you're really good at these kinds of things, which what you do for a living, this can be very stressful on a family with the dust flying and everything else.
Well, in full disclosure, it took me 8 years. I was married three times, got divorced. But other than that, no. My wife stuck with me
it's
through
hard,
the whole
though.
Thing.
It's very
it was
stressful.
A lot of work. Yeah. It was very stressful. You have to be up for it. Yeah. She, my wife was, God bless her, and she helped a lot. So we were totally.
Do you have kids then?
Well, as a matter of fact, I got pictures of my son as a 3-year-old hammering stuff, and there was, you know, floors were torn up or whatever. When children number 2 and 3 came, that's when we moved out because we needed more space and all of that. Yeah. But it worked out well.
That's what we found, Kevin. You know, he did all the hard work, but he sent us an email saying, how do I get wallpaper off
come
the wall?
On.
And the rest is history. Now he's our host.
How are you as a landlord, by the way?
Have you seen the smile?
How are you as a landlord?
Pretty good.
Are you really?
We've got tenants that are in there 5 years straight now.
He's
and my approach is they call, something's wrong, we jump on it instantly.
Yep.
So long as they're good tenants, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's their house.
You know,
I want them to think it's their house.
What a question.
Yeah. What?
If you have an apartment and your landlord works for this old house, you've hit
the jackpot,
haven't you? I mean, it's not like calling you if you have a problem.
Well, no, I just call Tommy and said, Tommy, go over to my place, fix it.
We all get calls from Kevin.
Do you?
Yeah.
Well, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I guess I would. Okay, Kevin, let's go back to the calls. You're doing great so far.
So Scott from Haverhill, you've been hanging out in the same house?
Yeah, I just want to say I love PPR and this old house. Marjorie, you're the voice of reason.
Oh, here we go.
Thank you.
And Richard's the man. But in reference to people...
What am I? Wait a second. So she's the voice of reason. He's the man or whatever he is. What are Kevin and I? Nothing?
Well, you figure it out for yourself.
Thank you.
But
go ahead, Scott.
I live in a house that was my parents' house. We moved there in 1959. And through the course of people turn over houses, there's been 5 generations of my family to live in this one house. Now, I consider myself the caretaker. And this house virtually is unchanged since the day my mother and father bought it. It's just been maintained to the highest levels possible. And now, when this family get-togethers, they're very nostalgic because of all the history that's gone on in the house. I couldn't imagine selling the house and then driving by and not having a member of my family living in this house.
There you go. Yeah. So, Scott, you are the exception to the rule because most Americans are moving every 5 to 7 years, but it's great that you're still there. And you don't have to be that creepy family driving by on the day after Thanksgiving like my family to the new people living in your house. So that's great. Good to hear.
We are just stewards of these buildings, actually.
Yeah. Scott, thanks. Can we get back to Lexington for 1 second before we get back to the Coles? Richard, first for you. I know you say this is what is it called, a colonial revival? What do they call these new colonials? Is that what it is? Sorry, okay.
Well, but this one's a garrison colonial.
What does that mean?
It means there's a little overhang. The second floor overhangs the front of the first floor just a little bit.
Oh, but it's a new a newish colonial.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's in a sea of traditional older colonials. And my experience is whenever anybody tries – not this is too broad a statement – often when developers try to recreate history in something new – it is so grotesque looking.
Yeah.
It is unbelievable. Yeah. Was that
you know
piece
when they
the
put
problem?
The round windows on the colonial that they didn't quite get it? So,
I'm serious. Is that
It's hard to do it well. It's hard to do it well. I was just at a house this morning that looked like a French chateau. You know, and I said, is this stucco. Is this real stucco? Mm-hmm. Is this modern drive-it? And it was one of the originals. It's hard to do that look of the original well, you know. But there are materials now that you can do it with. You know, this hardy plank you can make it look like the old claps. You can do things with modern materials that can look very much like that original colonial.
What's the big for both of you? What's the major things that are going to happen to this Lexington 1966 house when they're done, Kevin O'Connor?
Well, there's a dramatic difference to the front facade. Mm. A garrison colonial with that sort of typical overhang goes away because it gets a new front farmer's porch, which is a great addition. Mm-hmm. You only have to take three steps up. The porch runs the length of the front of the house. It's got a roof with pillars and lights. The kitchen, which hasn't been touched in about 60 years, gets completely blown up, made larger and big, modernized.
Big and open to the backyard, light coming in. It becomes the space that nobody will ever leave. There's two fabulous islands in the kitchen that really are great for a family of five.
And in more space, because it is a family of five. Two of the daughters were sharing a bedroom, so they wanted to add a couple bedrooms. And in this case, we bumped up over the garage so that they got two additional bedrooms, a bath, and a laundry room. And that is just a great way to add on to a house. I mean, mm-hmm. think about it.
Yeah.
If you had the choice of sort of building a new foundation and a whole new structure out back and connecting to the house, or going above an existing structure like a garage where you just have to pop up the roof, it's very efficient.
Yeah.
And it worked in this house because it was sized properly. Yeah. And so those are the big changes for this family.
It's not germane to your question, but interesting how these people ended up in this house. They rented in this neighborhood and fell in love with the neighborhood and wrote a letter that they put in every single mailbox in the area.
I think I mentioned this last time.
It's crazy. And they just wanted to be in this neighborhood.
And so if anybody's putting their house in the market, please call us right away. They avoided the realtor's fees, which is wonderful. You know, we just got an email from Debbie from Dunstable who's asking you the question that you have probably been asked a million times. But since it is a joke.
Kevin's great.
Okay. Actually, that was not the question. The question is, she's a big fan of the show. She says, how does this old house decide what to renovate and where and who pays?
We've asked that question before, but
tell us. We have asked.
The short answer is that all of our houses, all of our homeowners come to us via the mailbag. People email us, write us. Lots of people do that, but eventually that's where we get them from. We're looking for a story to tell, so we sort of start with a story idea. Hey, let's celebrate the colonial form, and then we go out and we find something that matches that description. Hey, we want to tell a story about two families, or we want to do a timber frame, what have you. Start with the story, find the house that matches. And in terms of the cost, the homeowners are pretty much on the hook for the entire cost. However, donations of materials and product that come in that they'd like to accept actually comes off of the bill. So they get a pretty good deal. I mean, they get Tom Silva and the boys building the house, which is the best deal going. But the cost comes down by about 15 or 20% because of the freebies.
At least.
So does somebody ever say to you, you come in with a great plan to renovate the house, and they say, well, gee, that's about $40,000 out of our budget. So you can renegotiate as it goes along.
Yeah, we might not do as well as we should explaining all that stuff sometimes, you know, but there are times that we have to say, no, we can't do that. It's still their house.
Yep.
I think back to a story 10, 15 years ago. This house, we wanted to have the historians come in and to do historical paint chips to find out microscopically exactly what the original paint was on this 1700s house, and we find out that it's this beautiful umber sort of orange, and we paint the house beautifully. And the homeowner says, I just hate it.
Oh.
After you did it?
Oh, no.
Well, we had the historian.
Oh, no.
She grew to love it. She grew to love it. But we realized that it was this delicate balance between a TV show and somebody's own house. Yeah. And
How long did it take before she grew to love it?
You warm up the umber in about 9 minutes. I don't know.
Oh my God.
She prefer? Pink? Is that what she preferred?
Kevin.
I'm sorry.
How can this be over? I feel like we just started.
It is over.
Yeah. Oh. God,
but there's always next month.
Okay. Kevin O'Connor is the host of This Old House. Richard Trithewey is their plumbing and heating expert. Boy, that flew by. For their TV schedule and other information, you can call them at thisoldhouse.com. Thank you both for coming in. This was most fun.
It's great to see you.
And thanks to the rest of you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We've got open mic with Juliette Kyan. We also review the State of the Union address. Brian McGroy from the Boston Globe is going to be with us as he is every Wednesday. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our team, Chelsea Murray, Will Rose, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, our engineer, John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you for listening, and please tune in again tomorrow. See you later.